Good evening. I'd like to call to order the study session of September 6, 2016. At the conclusion of this study session, we'll be going into a closed executive session. Our published agenda noted that the executive session would include a discussion related to labor negotiations. Our study session will be completed at approximately 7 p.m. Then we'll go into executive session, and our executive session will be completed at approximately 7:30 p.m. The city manager has also suggested that we convene an executive session to discuss pending and potential litigation. This particular matter is not presently on tonight's agenda. I propose that it be added and that we convene that session following the city manager's report near the end of our regular meeting.
So moved.
Second.
Thank you. Are there all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? Thank you very much. So before beginning our study session, let's go around the table and introduce ourselves to one another. Mr. Arnold.
Jay Arnold.
Shelley Klova.
Kurt Triplett.
Sherry Harris.
Marilyn Beard.
Toby Nixon.
Doreen Marshoni.
Penny Sweet.
Dave Asher.
And Amy Wallen. Thank you very much, City Manager.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Mayor, members of the council. So we're getting close to the end of a long journey on our police strategic plan. I'm going to hand you off to Deputy City Manager Marilyn Beard to walk you through it, but I just wanted to say a few quick remarks. The first is to thank Marilyn, who's taken this from the very beginning, as well as Chief Harris, for shepherding this to this point. We're getting very close to the end. Also an outstanding group of consultants who've been working with us that you're going to meet today, but it's a very good product, and it's because it's been in great hands. So I want to say thank you to Marilyn and Sherry for getting us here, and I'll go ahead and turn it over to Marilyn Beard.
Thank you. Good evening. So it's the end, but it's the beginning, so of another long journey. Tonight's presentation is primarily going to be made by the Burke team, the Burke consulting team, and it's going to be a presentation of their findings and recommendations that are in the report. And I think they'll introduce themselves, and they'll be taking turns with the presentations and be taking questions from you. So what we're really looking for tonight from you is any questions, follow-up, concerns, anything on the report itself that you would want to see additional information on, or any changes in the document, because once we get that, we'll bring back a final document for you to adopt by resolution. Then also based on your remarks, then in the first meeting in October, the chief will be working with city manager's office to develop a response similar to what we've done with other strategic plans, what their response and what their comments are on the recommendations, what they've already done, what they would recommend as priorities, and then based on feedback from council at that time, then we'll develop a work plan and be checking in with the Public Safety Committee and then periodically with the City Council. And we'll prepare a matrix like those that we did for Development Services and the Fire Strategic Plan, with a list of recommendations, how to address them, and when they should be addressed. Like all strategic plans, the implementation is going to take time. It's going to take place as resources are available and over the next 5+ years. So we'll accomplish as much as we can, take the low-hanging fruit. The chief has already started implementing many of the recommendations that are in the report, and so she'll be able to tell you about what she's doing so far. One of the challenges that was noted is the number of vacancies in the department, which is also going to constrain their ability to respond to some of the recommendations. There's some things that we can do right away, but if it involves the officers, patrol officers, or I think most everybody that's sworn now is going to have to go out on patrol again, but they had so many vacancies, so that's going to be a little bit constraining, but we'll do the best that we can. Also note that a number of the recommendations will require a negotiation with the Guild, but the Guild has been with us from the very beginning, from the selection of the consultant all the way through the process and reading the recommendations, so we are aware of what's out there, but that may take some time as well, so just something to think about. With that, I think I'm going to hand it off to the consultant team, and Brian Murphy, who was the project manager for this project, and he'll introduce his team. They'll be available to answer questions as our staff available to answer questions, and we'll be taking notes. We'll answer as many questions as we can tonight, and there's probably some that we'll not be able to answer, but we'll bring it back to you. Okay.
All right. Thank you, Marilyn. Madam Mayor, members of the council, we're very pleased to be here this evening. So my name is Brian Murphy, and I'm a principal with Burke, and I was a project manager for this effort. Really proud of the work and happy to be here tonight to share our recommendations and take your feedback and answer your questions. As Marilyn said, I think there's a lot of hard work ahead for the city and for the department. If we've done our job, I think we've teased up the right questions and given you some real good direction and real specific recommendations for you to pursue as you go forward. Good evening. So I am joined this evening by my colleague Kristen Mate from Burke, and then from by Virginia and Tag Gleason, who are part of the what we've called the Burke team. But we're actually missing a few analysts from the Burke team, and also Karen Daniels, who did the work on corrections. And then finally, I wish we could have the full committee up here, because we had great support and great participation by members of the Kirkland Police Department committee that did the work, and a lot of staff and quite a few community members who gave input. And I'll touch base on that part of the process in just a moment, but we'll just stress that this has been a very collaborative process. It's been a challenging process, and we've wrestled with a lot of tensions and ideas, and we're happy to bring this forward this evening. And I trust that you'll interrupt us as you have questions and as you'd like more detailed information. Otherwise, we're going to try to move through fairly quickly so that we can have time during this 1 hour to have your questions. And this process both involved analysis and discussion and recommendation. The high points are here. We think you're starting from a strong point, but we think there's more that you can do and should do and need to do to preserve your good relationship with the Kirkland community and to be able to deliver the type of policing, law enforcement services, correction services that the community desires. Our presentation tonight, I'll touch base briefly on the process, and I'll tee up the recommendations around operations, and then we're going to cover a little bit on organizational development and some need to continue to address changes happening in the environment. So it was a seven-month planning process. We started back in February of 2016. And we started by putting an ear out and listening to some community members and to listening to council and to city leadership, both department heads and also the city manager, and then talking a lot with Kirkland police employees in different positions within the city. We had four meetings of a really terrific steering committee. It was a diverse group of 18 members from across the department. As Marilyn said, we had representation from the Guild. We had representation from both commissioned and non-commissioned personnel across the department. We met four times with that group, and also before and after each meeting, we met with this core planning team that really helped shepherd the process. That wasn't enough, though. We needed to go out and talk with more people throughout the department. So TAG had shift meetings with each of the shifts. We had five different meetings with patrol in total. Karen met with corrections, I believe, a total of four times. We also met with non-commissioned personnel and command staff separately and put forward an online survey later in the process to get input. So we tried to do as much as we could to cast a wide net. We heard a lot of things that were very, very positive, and I think it's worth emphasizing that we think the department's in a good position, the city's in a good position, and you're doing a good job together of working together to preserve safety and in the community. There was a lot of support for community engagement on the part of KPD. There was also a desire for more, a desire very clearly we heard from community members and from the department for more engagement and more interactions with the community that are not around law enforcement directly, but around building relationships, around building communication channels and intelligence channels and back and forth. And we think you'd be well served by that. And as you've seen, many of our recommendations focus on that. Folks within the department took pride in what they do. And it was mentioned that they appreciate the support that they get from the city council and from the city as well. The new facility was certainly a frequent comment about the appreciation for that. The biggest focus of our recommendations are around building on that positive relationship with the community. We did quantitative analysis that Kristen will speak to in just a moment that really bore out the idea that your officers right now are largely running from call to call. It's a very reactive model. They have very little time in their day or in their week or in their month to be involved in activities that are not directly related to a citizen-generated call. We think in this time of strained relationships between police and community across the country, and in this time of change in Kirkland, as you get bigger and a more complicated city, it's important to invest in additional capacity to have those kinds of interactions with the community that builds relationships and that builds that connective tissue. That the fortunate position you're in now is not one to be taken for granted, and I think that it requires some additional investment in officer capacity to build up that ability. From that idea of a model shift, of moving from a reactive model to a more proactive model where the force would have more time for community relationships and preventative policing, there's a lot of recommendations that kind of ripple from that around the need for data to inform some of that proactive policing and around the need for communications back and forth with the community, revised command structure, et cetera, revised performance metrics that better align with that new model. So that'll be the focus of a lot of our conversation this evening. But first, let's dive into the numbers, and Kristen's going to talk through what it is we saw in the quantitative analysis.
Hi, good evening. So one of the first things we did was try to understand, do officers have capacity in their day currently to take on some of this proactive work? And what we did is we kind of looked at February as a case study to see, to match the hours that officers are working with the calls for service that they were receiving in that month. And we kind of got this model that you're seeing on the left, where officers are spending almost 50% of their day responding to citizen-generated calls for service. So that looks like it's only 50% of their day, but there's a lot of follow-up work that's involved in these calls. There's also report writing that takes place. So this is really a reactive model where officers are running from call to call, and with their breaks that are part of their contract and also the officer-initiated activities that they're doing, this is really what we're seeing is a reactive model. So then we also wanted to kind of look at, we did a workload-based assessment to see if we dedicated more time in their day to these proactive activities, what would that look like? How many additional officers would we need? And this model on the right is kind of thinking, if they had this time, what would it look like? So the workload-based assessment, we built a model in Excel. These are the steps that we went through to get there. The high level of this is that we were looking at over the last year, from April 1st, 2015 to March 31st, 2016, how many calls for service was the department receiving? How much time was it taking to respond to those calls? How many officers were providing backup? How much of their time was it taking? And then how many officers does it take to respond to these calls, taking into consideration their vacation time, their sick time? And so we wanted to see, what is this going to look like? And if we know right now it's taking about 50% of their time to respond to these citizen-generated calls for service, but what if they only had 33% of their time to do this, to allow for more time in their day, to be more proactive, to be building those relationships with the community? And what we found when we applied this performance objective, which was based in our interviews with the patrol officers, what we were hearing from the community, what we were seeing in the city council goals, is that you would need about 10 to 12 more full-time officers to be able to shift to this model. Some of the benefits of shifting to this model, like Brian spoke to, are you have more time for community partnerships and you have more time for problem solving. But this does have ripple effects throughout the rest of the department. And Virginia's going to speak to some of the recommendations that tie back to this analysis.
I'd like to question this particular piece of it. Might as well jump in here. You haven't questioned what's being done. So what's being done is the right what. Is that correct?
Could you rephrase the question?
The things that are currently being done
yep.
are necessary. Is that correct?
Yes. So the majority of their time is spent on calls that are being generated by citizens. So they're calling 911. They're saying, I need an officer to respond to this. And it's taking up most of their time. A lot of the other activities that are taking up their time are things that have to be done, like report writing. We do make some recommendations around how to reduce the time that officers are spending on that work, but...
Yeah, I would think that it's at least worth a discussion internally that maybe once you do the process improvement of how these things are done, who does them, then becomes the next thing. And I think that you get into a later recommendation that comes up that you don't have to have sworn officers doing all of these things. And I think that that's a good recommendation. It puts the highly skilled, experienced officers where they need to be more of the time. But once you do that, I think what you're looking for is then the link to be able to generate the community connections. If I understand correctly what you're looking for, you're trying to get some slack to be able to accomplish that. You accomplish it with additional FTE on patrol, doing the similar kind of things that are there, whereas I think that we can look at a shift of who does what and what's done. And provide maybe, I would make the analogy of the cavalry in contact with the citizenry in contact, and then you have the next level back that becomes the more experienced and the community police connection that gives you the depth and breadth of experience. And I think rather than just adding numbers to FTE and patrol, how you organize that effort and how you direct that effort, I think can be very valuable to us over the long run.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. The model is just making more time in one officer's day, but there's other ways to allocate the time to make these connections.
Okay. Yep. Thank you.
So my question is similar. If you go back to the pie charts, just to make sure that I understand this. This is an average across all the department, right?
It's an average across the patrol officers.
The patrol. So if you want to move the averages, you can change everybody's workday, or you, as Dave was saying, you can just have people who are dedicated to the community policing functions have some continuing to be dedicated to the reactive model, and you still move the average that way.
Yes, right? That's correct.
Okay.
How much of this reaction is the 10% decrement in who shows up? You know, we've got a 54 out of the 60. Is that a material piece?
So we ran the model with the current assumptions of the 54 officers working in February, and that's how we got to the 45%. But this is an additional 11 FTE over the authorized level of 60 officers. So it doesn't matter how many are there now. You would need 11 additional to handle the call volume you're currently receiving and make time for these additional activities. I don't know if that answered your question.
But
yep.
There's kind of a, if I'm hearing you correctly, Dave, I mean, what you're saying is if we enhance some of that community, you know, whether it be neighborhood resource officer or neighborhood planning support, whatever.
Yeah.
That if we concentrate on FTEs that do that, there is likely the ability to leave that old model.
Well, I don't know.
Except you don't want to leave that old.
Yeah, exactly. You're still going to have to do that work. That work was, my first question was, is what they're doing valid? And the answer was yes.
I think it still has
to be done. It's just who does it.
I think the point I was going to try and make was, I believe that the current configuration is probably somewhat frustrating for the officers because they don't get to do this stuff in the shift model. And it would seem to me that the more broadly we can have our officers actually connecting with the community members, the better it is, rather than just having a few focused members out in the community.
It's worth the discussion,
right?
Thing I brought up.
Well, and what I was getting at with the averaging is you don't necessarily have your officers on graveyard shift doing the community policing because everybody's in bed that they would be wanting to talk to. Or at least maybe they should be.
There's a different community.
There's a different community.
That's right. Yeah, so you need more on day shift who would have time to do that, but not necessarily this extra time for community policing on the night shift.
Yeah, where I got hung up, and it didn't take long for me to get hung up, was the discussion where the chief of police stood in front of the then city council after the numbers had been reduced significantly from the proposal from the prior chief, and said, in the annexation, this is how many we need, and that's how many we don't need anymore. And that was what we have, the 60, plus PROACT. That was in open session, after serious questioning, those numbers were vetted and reinforced by our department. We don't need any more. Now, I forgot to bring the 2000-2003 police strategic plan, which when you open it up is community policing. So it's not just because of community policing. There's some other things. I don't necessarily disagree that we may have to have some additional folks. It's on this side of the river. It's interesting that the other side was a different answer. But I want to make sure that we look at it very, very closely as to how we do what we do. I like the community policing where this team is going with community policing, the things that are being done, and maybe to get those things, because there's more flesh on these bones about community policing than has been in any previous strategic plan. So maybe to get that, we have to go there. Going there is going to be hugely expensive, so we need to go there as deliberately as possible.
So the roadmap for this conversation is we get the initial briefing from the consultants tonight, and then our staff come back to us with their response and their thoughts, and is that right?
Right. An implementation plan.
Okay.
Priorities.
Because we won't necessarily be implementing all of these recommendations. Right. We'll be prioritizing them. Okay.
And then you, city manager, will probably have
some
budget.
Recommendations.
Right. Yeah.
Ms. Clova?
So kind of adding on to that, I know the beginning slide talked about there was some community outreach, sitting with different members of the community, the faith community, et cetera, and getting their input about, you know, current state. So this represents a bit of a change and will certainly have an impact on people's pocketbooks. So have we taken these recommendations back out, or is there a plan in that process to take it back out and say, well, here's what we came up with the input, and what do you think of that?
I think it's a perfect question, and I would use it to say you have a lot of conversation ahead of you with your community and with your department. I think that what I would have you focus on in terms of a headline is this model shift towards more community policing, and you will need more capacity to do that. There are ways to find efficiencies. There are ways to find the right staffing model to do that. You have a conversation about whether it's a PROACT unit or more community-oriented policing. The 11, I think, is helpful in terms of order of magnitude scale of a starting point. We have a lot of conversation, I think, as to whether it's 5 or 15, and then whether your community wants to pay for that. And if so, what do they expect to see when that that additional force gets added? So I think the 11 has to be there in terms of an answer of an analysis that we were asked to do, but it's actually our recommendation is not to add 11 FTE. It's not that simple. I wish we could just throw more people at it, but you have more conversation, I think, to have internally within the city and within your community. And Virginia's actually poised to talk more about some of those implications. So.
So when you look at what the consequences would be to the department of making a shift of moving more of the patrol officer time or officer time in general, it proactively in community policing activities, you have to think about how that's going to affect other departments. So, for example, if there is more officer-initiated activity as a result of some of these community policing plans, you have to be thinking about, is this going to require additional crime analysis capacity? So if you're going to be having engagement with community groups and talking to them about what their priorities are and trying to align them with the city priorities as well, you're going to need some additional crime analysis capacity to be able to do that. Later on in the report, we talk about a couple of options about doing locally, not citywide policing plans, but some smaller neighborhood ones. But all of these activities have additional resources that need to be provided in the department. Another thing that we talked about was looking at this use of limited and non-commissioned personnel. So there is a movement that is being very strongly advocated for and developed in Canada and some other places, few cities in the United States, where they're looking at a model they call tiered policing, where exactly what you mentioned, that you have highly trained officers doing the things you need highly trained officers to do, looking at whether you could have limited commissioned officers. And we have areas around here, such as the city of Redmond, that have what they call patrol support officers that take some of those duties that don't require that high level of training. Maybe they don't need to be armed, but they can do transports and they can do evidence handling. So to be looking at the range of activities that could be done by a limited or non-commissioned personnel, and though it's not the goal to save money, often what you'll find out is that the training, the hiring, and the equipment resources needed for these personnel are substantially less, and you can still get a really valuable body of work done at a lower cost. When we first brought this up and we included the union president, they were very receptive to have a discussion about this. So they believe that having people to provide that support to the police officers would be of value to the department. So unlike a lot of other departments and a lot of other officers, they want to be part of a solution at looking creative and unusual and, you know, new ways of providing service with a lot of value to the city. In discussing this with some of the department directors as well as with the officers, they all expressed the feeling that when they're out there dealing with the community, they wish they had just a little bit more time. So some of the department directors we talked to from the city said it would be of great value to us if we knew we had one or two officers who were part of a group that we could count to regularly come to our community meetings to talk about what's happening with the parks, to talk about long-term plans for the Cross Kirkland corridor and how we can make sure that we keep that safe in the long run, who can work with what we call SEPTED, community crime prevention through environmental design. As you're creating your two very upcoming new developments, we'd like to work with the people in those communities to talk about how we can make that safe so that we're not being reactive. We can talk about how we might be able to work with parking and fences and lighting and things to keep things safe before they become a problem. So a lot of that really came from the officers and their supervisors talking about how important it was to them to be able to offer that service so that people feel very safe working here, living here, and doing business here every day.
Mr. Asher has a question. A
couple of points. The SEPTED needs to be in our design review. And I don't think we've ever made that link. We need to wrap that into design review and wrap probably the police expertise into that. These two major developments have been through design review, and they were approved based on what we had as design guidelines, but I think that's a dimension that we just haven't looked at. So that's a great thing. I need some help with a concept that you've got in here that I didn't understand. It's on page 24 of the report under recommendation number 8. It says, with additional demands on patrol related to preventive policing, current level of felony case investigation could change and increase demand for additional investigative support or additional detectives. I really didn't get the connection of the first part of that sentence to the second. How can preventive policing increase felony case investigation?
Well, there are a lot of kinds of cases that, for whatever reason, don't get investigated. So whether they're...
We're not investigating felonies?
There are some felonies that if you can't gather the information that would be appropriate to hit a filing standard. So one thing happens, you have more police out there with more contacts, you're bringing in more cases that are getting filed that go to the detectives that need more crime analysis and need more record support. And so the more you're out there, probably the more arrests are going to be made and the more cases are going to be filed. The other thing that happens is there's some cases that are just hard to put together the evidence for them to file. And there's also certain parts of the community, if they feel like this isn't a high priority for the department, they don't report a lot of crimes. So part of that is looking at other ways that people can report crimes, even if you're just using it for statistics and it's not necessarily something you're going to respond to. It helps you give a better picture of what's going on in your neighborhoods. And if you have more crime analysis, you can sort of see where trends come and go. So one, for example, Chief Harris had asked a question about how are we going to know how these new developments are impacting us. We don't want to wait until it's too late and we're being reactive. Yeah. So having some chance to get some crime analysts who would be able to look at some similar developments and came up with a couple of ideas of ones that might be somewhat similar, such as the Mill Creek development that they have that might be a little similar to what you have here, and find out what was the difference as that was developed over time and the types of businesses they had there. What was the additional demand on police needs? But that's something that right now there's just not the ability and there's the time for the officers to work on. There's not enough crime analyst time to be able to put some of that information together to plan. And what makes it a little more complicated and what was mentioned a couple times earlier is police vacancies. It would be great if you guys approve something in the budget and they could go out and hire someone. The time from when you get budget authorization to when you actually have an officer off probation who can work independently on the street can be almost 2 years. And it's complicated right now because we're having some capacity issues at the academy. So a lot of these plans have to be done quite a ways in advance, and then deciding whether you want fully commissioned or limited commissioned, along with getting the plans in place to be able to get them hired, get them trained, and get them out on the street is a pretty, it's a lot of moving parts that have to plan. So even if you were to say tomorrow, we're going to add 11 patrol officers, it's not going to happen for a long time. So it needs to be part of a longer term strategy. A lot of this I already mentioned. Another item that I just wanted to touch on a little bit was using technology very strategically. It's another opportunity, as you were talking before, try to make some efficiencies and some changes early on and see if you can help create some of that additional capacity and additional resources for the employees using technology. there are some opportunities, and I think that you have chief and leaders who are very interested in learning more about it and trying to use it efficiently within the department. But right now, the two or three of the key components of using technology in the department are absolutely maxed out, especially related to the crime analysis and the ability to quickly turn some things around. There's some opportunities with a couple technologies that are underway already, including CopLogic doing some online reporting, as well as looking at ways that you might be able to capture some of your crime information and have it available in a really easy-to-use visual tool for the public.
A question for you, Virginia.
Thank you. In looking at the details of the report, your specific recommendation, or your recommendations were very specific on some things that could happen within our current tool set or enhancements to our current tool set for online reporting and such. And I have a question for staff on, this is something I'm interested in, if there is concurrence from the department I'm moving quickly on, and is there going to be the opportunity to look at, as we're looking at budget, some opportunities to move fast on some of these investments that might be able to deliver some quick wins?
So we are very close to having CopLogic in place. That's been, NORCOM's been working on that for us. And they're just now creating the interface between CopLogic and the records so that you don't have to take it and then hand enter it. So they're very close on that. And so we think we should be able to, and that came to us as part of the package of that came with Tyler. So we are the technology, the neural technology. So we're really close on that. And so, you know, you have the software and then you need to have an implementation plan. So you need to know, you know, all of those reports still need to be reviewed by a commissioned officer, but they don't all need to be followed up necessarily. We need to get the word out about it. We need to tell the public, use this tool. Here's how you use it. Here's what it's good for. And but we're really close on that. So I think before the end of the year, probably.
That'll totally be up to Tyler. And that interface.
Yeah,
but we're currently testing that internally to see how it works.
Excellent. If I might go along with that, when I got into the crime analyst recommendation for additional FTE, my mind went immediately to providing some programming assistance, and maybe ad hoc, to the crime analysts to be able to put together what they've been, you know, canned reports that they've been putting together on an ad hoc basis, so they can get those out into the field and maybe accessible and let the patrol run the query, if we can set it up in such a way, and then maybe come back in 6 months or a year and revisit. You know, what's been, that should give a lot more ability to what that analyst can produce if they can sort of categorize the kinds of reports that are being asked for and get them out where they don't have to come to the analyst to ask for them, but we produce it and let the officer on the beat be able to access those.
Okay. And one follow-up. You mentioned increased public access via website and social media. And I agree with the goals in the details of the plan about improving use of social media and making it more of a two-way interaction, but there isn't the detail in the draft plan on how you're going to do that. And as this goes forward, I'm wondering if there can be some more specifics. You mentioned that other places like the state and King County have social media policies, but I think there's the opportunity to go to the next level and examine what other departments are doing. Seattle, for example, does an incredible job with their real-time social media where they're providing information as emergencies are happening. And it may be a model worth looking at to say, not only should this be a goal of using social media, but here's kind of a roadmap to get there. Yeah. And I'm wondering if you could beef that up a little bit as this report goes from draft to final.
Absolutely, and it would be very easy to put together a list of local resources to either show what they've done or describe how they put it together, what kind of technology they're using. This is mentioned a little bit later in the slides, but you are uniquely located in an area where you have some very, very civic-minded companies that love to help police departments. And I know that they would be willing to help you, especially related to visualizing some of the crime data. I know that they would be happy to help. I work at the City of Seattle. I worked at the police department. Now I'm the governance advisor for the IT department. And so I spent a little time finding out who the people were who would be able to help with either building automatic queries for the crime data that's there. There are a few limitations with the New World system and getting some of that information, but they probably can work through those. But there's a lot you could be doing, as well as proactively putting out on your website some of the crime information and then maybe breaking it down by either patrol sector or even smaller than that. But sort of another way to have that community connection, to really be getting out there and letting people even be able to run some of their own crime information for particular neighborhoods. So I think a lot of people now rely on real estate sites and other places that probably are not operating on the most current information. One of the things...
Are you familiar with our crime mapping?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. So and there are some enhancements you can have to what tool you have now. I think that one of the things that we saw when we looked at Kirkland vis-a-vis some of your neighboring communities is there's a lot of good information that's out there about Kirkland that needs to be out more. For whatever reason, some of the really good things that are happening in Kirkland, especially as they relate to safety, I think ought to be out more easily for the public to see.
So part of that conversation would obviously be about manpower, right? Because that's more staffing as well than we have currently.
Related to the...
A stronger social media presence.
And yeah, and that's another area that is very well suited for a limited or non-commissioned person to do.
Mm-hmm. So that would be included in your number of 11?
That could be, yeah. So how that total number of FTEs is divided up really would be part of how the department... it works to implement the plan. Mm-hmm. There are some aspects of technology where it's helpful to have a commissioned person because they are going to be using some of the tools in a way where maybe they're not an FTE, but one of the things we called it in the report was a technology champion, a person who has at least enough time, maybe part of their unallocated time is being that technology champion, being able to look at what's happening at other departments and maybe in the community and finding out what tools would be really helpful to them. There are a lot of stories of departments who get new technological tools that are kind of interesting for a little while, but they're not really a meaningful integrated part of their technology suite. So speaking with your technology manager, they were very willing to engage with the department to make sure that whatever technological tools the police department got fit well within having a centralized IT department, that it's something that works for the city as well as works for the department.
Are there examples around the world of departments that are using technology very, very well that we might be able to tap into?
There are, and there's a lot of materials that I know that we'd be happy to make available. And some of it, I mean, New York has an incredible real-time crime center, but it's millions of dollars a year and lots of staff. There are a lot of examples of departments that would be similar size to the city of Kirkland that I think would be helpful. It also is helpful that you have a centralized IT department and that it is run primarily through because you're not going to be buying systems that aren't compatible with what the rest of the city has. So.
Hope not.
Better do a time check. It's quarter to, and we need to finish up right at 7.
Right.
Yep.
Yes.
I've got one question on the page, I think, that you, before we leave. You indicate that the city attorney's office sets, and I'll leave out a phrase, just misdemeanor priorities for the community.
So
I've never seen that.
It So unlike, I mean, what's another great feature of Kirkland is you have sort of that vertical alignment of your criminal justice system. You have corrections. You have a city attorney that has, you know, contract prosecutors. You have your court. You, if you were contracting with someone else maybe who set some of your priorities, you might have crimes that you want to have prosecuted in the city of Kirkland that don't reach the level of importance to another place. But you own your criminal justice system from top to bottom. You can set some of your own priorities. Obviously, you can't make something illegal that isn't a crime. But I can tell you there's a lot of cities where there are crimes where they just say, that doesn't rise to the level of what we're willing to spend our time on. There's places that say, we don't prosecute car prowls. We don't even investigate car prowls. We're not going to, we'll give you a number for your insurance, but that, we have so many other things going on that isn't something that is a priority for our city. Same thing for prostitution and some drug crimes. So you have the ability to work as an integrated city unit to decide what your priorities are, and you own all the pieces of the system to make that work.
So one clarification. They're referring to the prosecutor. Often the prosecution is provided by the city attorney's office. It's the prosecutor that works with the police department about filing standards, and so that's how that works. This city attorney isn't particularly
involved. Yeah, I'd like to discuss it in the public safety committee with the city attorney sometime.
Right, but they do, the city attorney's office does manage the prosecutor's contract, but the prosecutors work most closely with the police department on filing.
Yeah, that was strange. Thank you.
All right.
So I know we're running out of time.
Yeah, I'm worried about running out of time.
Okay. So we can talk a little bit about performance measurements, and that's just about having, small-scale crime prevention plans, community policing plans. There's an examples on the Seattle website that you can look at. They've broken it down into quite a few neighborhoods, and each neighborhood can look at what is the crime in my particular neighborhood. They go back to the neighborhood once a year and say, tell us what your priorities are. We can't guarantee that we will respond to all of those, but we will help you track those, and we will take that into consideration with your district commander on determining what priorities are in your own neighborhood. And records, there's a lot of challenges related to records. There's a big backlog from when you switch from one system to the next. You probably need to get rid of that backlog so that because a number of things happen when you have excess records that you don't need anymore. There's a lot of that's involved with indexing, keeping them, managing them. Strong belief in our communities about public disclosure, so you want to do it right and you want to do it on time. You just want to make sure you have the capacity to be able to have transparency and provide information to the public when they request it.
All right, so Karen Daniels, who did the work in corrections along with the corrections team from the police department, isn't able to be here tonight, but I want to touch on this. It's an important part of your system, and as Virginia said, it's pretty unique in Kirkland that you own this part of your system, your justice, law enforcement and justice system. You made a big change when you moved to the new facility, and you went from a bed capacity of 12 beds to more than 60. The daily population went from about 10, about a dozen, up to about 40. And perhaps most importantly is you're holding folks for more than 10 days. And you are no longer a brief holding facility where people transit in and out, but you have inmates that you're holding for a longer period of time. And there's an opportunity and a desire on the part of staff to have an impact on people while they are there to do the true work of corrections. Which is both holding inmates accountable and then providing opportunities and supports and programs for rehabilitation before release back into the community. So this has not really been articulated. So our first recommendation related to corrections was to truly articulate what is the role of corrections and how does it relate to the work of the full department, making sure that the vision and mission that's established for the department embraces the work of corrections, and that corrections can describe fully their goals and ambitions for the inmates that they serve. You notice there's a long list of recommendations around development of additional systems and processes and programs to support this, what I'd call a transformation from a holding facility to a correctional facility. I'd say it is a long list. I'd say it's also a very doable list. Karen did a nice job of putting it in order and of identifying the priorities. You clearly need to begin with that, getting your current inmate classification system validated, and that will drive many things. You'll have a better understanding of who your inmates are, and that can then really be used to inform an audit of your facility, your staffing plan, and then an inmate population management plan that includes more programs and partnerships to help provide the support for inmates before they're released. Strongly recommend that you do that work and kind of clean up things, get your house in order internally before looking to contract out that excess capacity that your current facility offers. We think there'd be a lot of risk, or there would be risk inherent in doing that before those systems and processes are fully strengthened. Any questions on the corrections piece?
Mr. Asher.
How will we know when they're ready? Is there a accreditation or an external review that we would call in and say, okay, they're there?
There's both. And so WASPIC has created accreditation standards for the jail, and they also provide, they've just started in this last year to provide on-site jail manager inspections and recommendations of your facility. So that would be something that we will, that we have on our to-do list to do.
Thanks.
Sure. So we've talked a lot about operations, and I think it's important that we talk about the organization as well, the culture and systems that support the working of the operation. So, Mr. Gleason.
I think talking about the harder aspects of budget and staffing is one thing. Some would call these the softer side of policing, but it's these softer issues that will define your organization and present it to the community. And you have a significant opportunity for exploring the mission, vision, and core values of the organization because you have a new chief, the department's expanded, has a new facility, and going through this process works on the communications process across the department, throughout the department. It gives the chief an opportunity to implant her vision of what she wants. And it's also an opportunity for the department to engage with the community. So that's an ongoing process that will take time. And it's not just an assembly of words. It's something that's meaningful. It's something that should be referred to, emphasize ethical judgment, the efficiency of the department, and go a long ways toward creating the image and enhancing the image of the department throughout the community. I'm just highlighting a few things in the interest of time. Retention, succession management, and recruitment. I like the emphasis on community policing. It emphasizes not only dealing with crime, the fear of crime and disorder, but it creates a mindset in the organization of critical thinking and problem solving. And you combine that community policing philosophy with community policing through environmental design, and it creates a critical thinking department where the community will not look to the department to solve its problems, but will look more to the department as a facilitator for problem solving across the entire city. So it brings other city departments together. It brings the community together. It's good for a collaborative effort. You have highly competent and energetic employees in the police department. The upside of that is they want to do a lot. The downside is they sometimes feel that they don't get an opportunity to demonstrate their skills and dig in the problems. So you allow people to get involved in solving problems, working with the community. That alone is a hiring, it's a recruiting process, draws people into the organization. It creates transparency in the organization because the police department will be regularly interacting in a way that the community will know. Here are our resources, here is what we can do, and there's a closeness that develops from that bond, and it can be very powerful in the long run. Performance evaluations, that's another discussion you want to have with the community to find out what do you value in the police department. Traditionally, police departments look at what's easily measured, arrest, clearance rates, that type of thing. So traditionally, that's what's there. But does that really measure what's of value to the community? If you're having problems, I would submit that your numbers won't persuade the community if they're fearful of something. So the fear of the community is something that needs to be addressed, and it's not addressed by traditional numbers. Communication, connection is collaborative leadership. Again, it's difficult for police leaders at times to unleash the tremendous ability of their officers because they sense responsibility for taking care of that situation. The chief in particular is responsible for the entire organization. However, it's good for your succession planning and your staff development if they're allowed to take responsibility for issues and fail at times and be responsible, because I think they'll learn from their experience, typically learning from mistakes and embarrassing situations, not as frequently when everything goes well. So it gives you an opportunity to develop your staff. So that's about it, unless you have any other questions on that, the softer side.
Mr. Arnold?
One of the things that you had touched on was recruiting, and one of the recommendations was increasing diversity. The report only discussed a couple of specific ideas, increasing points in pay for dual language speakers, partnerships and stuff like that. But my impression was that that's not going to get us there in a department that is 90% white and 84% male and it's commissioned officers. And I wonder if we could get some more specific recommendations on things we can do with our recruiting, with our diversity, and perhaps things not just in recruiting but throughout the department, which would help in retention and then therefore help in recruiting.
You can, and just a quick response to that. A somewhat different way of looking at diversity is to actually shift away from how diversity is defined in the national discussion that's underway. I'm working on some projects now where different segments of the community are being identified for specific outreach. Well, that segmentation of the community, that sorting of people, sometimes creates problems, because each of us is made up of several components. And if we do outreach to specific communities within our broader community, that can be difficult at times. So I would say what we're looking for in diversity goes beyond what we typically think of it, the national discussion being race, ethnicity, or gender. Look forward to age, educational experience, different job experiences. You want a mix of people, and I would suggest don't necessarily limit it to what's easily measured. And then bring all those diverse components together and start focusing on how we can make a collaborative community. So how can we get people, instead of fracturing into smaller segments, how can we bring our community together to work collaboratively? But a different approach on it, but somewhat off the mainstream.
Ms. Clova?
All right, I'll see if I can make this short. So you alluded a little bit to, you know, sort of performance measures, but I'm wondering if it's in the scope of this report to be able to put in some sort of accountability. We're big on accountability in this council, and, you know, if we were to implement the entire plan over a period of time, how would we know that our goals are being met? And, you know, to some of the discussion we've had, you might see an increase in crime reporting, you might see an increase in felonies. That could look like, well, wait, crime's getting worse. So are there ways in this, within the scope of this report, that we could come up with some ways to sort of measure, did we get there? Did we get to the goal?
You know, over the years, I wish I had an answer for that golden question. How do we know if we're successful? And what I keep coming back to in the literature will identify is, ask your community, what makes you think we're of value to you? What can we do that adds value? What's important to you? We think it's important to conduct this many traffic stops, arrest this many people, have this clearance rate, but does that mean anything to you? You know, what? How will we identify what a community wants? And that is part of that community engagement. What do you want from us as your service? And I know that's not easy black and white answer, but there isn't one out there.
Usually we want the numbers of people other than us caught doing things to increase.
Yeah, that's easy to do.
So
yeah,
it's a little tricky. Yeah. I get that. Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Overall, our community satisfaction scores in this area are very, very high, and we have a professional team that I'm really personally very proud of. So we can always improve, and we appreciate your report in identifying areas that will help us do that. Do you have any other comments before we close?
No, thank you very much for the time today. We appreciated your feedback, and we look forward to finalizing the report and working with staff.
Great. So, thank you very much. Okay. So we're going to go into a closed session to discuss labor negotiations, and we'll return at 7:30. Thank you. Good evening. We're back in session following a study session to discuss the police strategic plan and a closed executive session to discuss labor negotiations. Ms. Anderson, the roll, please.
Councilmember Nixon?
Here.
Councilmember Kloba?
Here.
Councilmember Asher?
Here.
Councilmember Marcioni?
Here.
Councilmember Sweet?
Here.
Deputy Mayor Arnold?
Here.
Mayor Wallen?
Here. Thank you very much. The first item on our agenda this evening is under communications. It's items from the audience. This is the time in our meeting when we hear from the public on matters which are not quasi-judicial or otherwise scheduled for public hearing. We ask that not more than three people speak on any one subject. However, if both proponents and opponents wish to speak, then up to three proponents and up to three opponents may address the council. We do have a public hearing this evening. It's on Resolution 5205, supporting initiative measure number 735, concerning a proposed amendment to the federal constitution. So if you do want to, if you're here to comment on that, we ask that you wait until our public hearing. In the meantime, I do have a sign-in sheet, and the first person to have signed in is Dee Dee Wren.
Rennie,
good evening.
Dee Dee Rennie.
Welcome.
I live at Houghton. I'm here representing myself and any senior citizen who agrees with me. I have lived in the same home for 40 years. I retired 2 years ago, and like many retired seniors, I live on a fixed income. I don't mind paying my fair share of taxes, but my property taxes went up $985 this year. With the housing market as it is, it would be difficult to find more affordable housing. The ST3 project is going to add another financial burden for seniors. These taxes will go on for years to come. I am originally from Portland, Oregon, where light rail has been used since the 80s. I was there just 3 weeks ago, and the traffic is terrible. Light rail works if you live near it. If someone lives 20 miles from the station, they won't want to travel through rush hour traffic to get to the transit centers. More buses and park and rides are needed. Buses can go anywhere and get more people to ride if it is made convenient for drivers. The cost to build and to ride buses or other alternative transit options would be a lot less than light rail. In my opinion, I see four reasons that light rail will not work. One, people don't want to give up their cars. Two, the population will keep growing. There are too many people in a concentrated space. Three, the stations won't be convenient to get to for most drivers. Four, by the time Sound Transit starts to build ST3, the technology will be obsolete. I hope everyone will consider the facts. Sound Transit makes it sound like it will help reduce congestion, but after seeing Portland's traffic, I know it won't alleviate or resolve the problems on the highways. I will have to pay approximately $600 more for all three of the tax increases if it goes through. I know many seniors feel the same as I do. It is getting more difficult for us to afford to live in Kirkland. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. The next person to have signed in is Frank Dennis.
I have a different shirt on today. Madam Mayor, Vice Mayor Arnold, thank you for coming and talking to Save Our Trail. Good to see you. And Ms. Marcioni, it's the first time I've had an opportunity to address you in person. I'm glad you're here. And Dave, Shelley, good luck on your race. We're going to vote for you. And Toby, thank you for everything. I'm here as the chair of the No ST3 group. And we're here tonight to ask you to come out against this Sound Transit proposal. There's a million reasons for that. I mean, you guys don't know me, but I've done billion-dollar projects all over the world. And I know what you should get for $1 billion. I know what you should get for $54 billion. And what we're going to get under this Sound Transit plan is not worth near what we're going to pay for it. Let me give you an example. Paris is extending their subway and light rail system 125 miles for $29 million. And that includes boring. Now, remember that a Coke costs $7 in France. Okay? So this is a horrible waste of money. It won't work. And it's going to, like Dee Dee and all of us, are going to be paying for this mess for a good long time. We're here, the NOST3 group, to ask you to step up, to say to anybody who will listen to you that the city of Kirkland rejects this proposal. And there's many reasons for it. I know that Councilmember Asher is very upset about the sub-area equity that's not been achieved. I know that many of you do not want any, even the prospect of having rail on our trail system, and we agree. That would be a horrible result. There are many, many different positions on this board, but we believe that there are enough of you who are against rails on that trail and who are against this horrible spending that we're being that's being forced upon us, to as a council to step up and say, we do not support ST3. There's three ways you can do it. You can say we are against it, and that's where we would ask you to be. Two, we do not support it. Okay, and third is nothing. All of those would be acceptable, or at least better than the position that you've taken so far, which seems to be mildly for it. I notice that your email and stuff has changed a little bit since January. You're no longer avidly for it. I would ask you to have a vote on it and to support that, and so thank you very much.
Sorry to interrupt. Thank you, Mr. Yeah. Dennis. Okay. The next person to have signed in is David Greshler.
Hello. David Greshler is one of the leaders of Save Our Trail and also a member of the NOST3 group. I just forgot my red shirt. I'm here to talk to you today about really one number, and it's not the $54 billion cost of ST3, and it's not the 50% contingency that Sound Transit has admitted is in that number. No, it's really the number we all should be asking ourselves when presented with a plan for $54 billion. And that number is, what are we getting in return? You know, public transportation is a critical part of a civilized society. You know, it's not just about getting people from their homes to work, to their families, to entertainment, and so on. It's also about reducing emissions. It's also about reducing traffic. And it's really about providing social justice for people who can't afford a car, right, to get them to the places they need to be. So how much of all that will Sound Transit provide? Right? Specifically, and this is the real number, how many new transit riders will be enabled if we spend $54 billion? So Sound Transit, in their response to that question from the Eastside Transportation Partnership, stated a specific number, 64,000 trips a day in 2040. Now, that kind of sounds like a large number, but bear this in mind. The Puget Sound Regional Council has stated that in 2040, there will be 18.9 million trips a day. So when you take 64,000 and you look at that number, you can see why this is truly transit for the less than 1%, actually. And for this, as you know, right, it will increase our property taxes, it will triple our car tax, and it will take our sales tax to 10% for less than 1% of the trips in 2040. So because of this, you know, I stand here with Frank and with others and ask you to really take a close look at Sound Transit 3 and take a stand, because this is going to impact us for 25 years or more. And, of course, I would encourage you to take a strong stand and vote no on Sound Transit 3. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. The next person to have signed in is Wayne Seminoff. Good evening, sir.
Hello. Yeah, my name is Wayne Seminoff, and I'm here to speak on the marijuana setback initiative. The main purpose of the initiative is to help voters get easy access to cannabis stores. That's the reason that this is all taking place. And right now, that's not the case. You have the Willows area will support probably three stores, and then there'll be one store by Costco. So there's not really very much dispersion that you're getting for the whole Kirkland area. And that is because right now there's a 1,000-foot setback. If you go to a 100-foot setback, then that'll open up more areas like in the middle of Totem Lake area, and even in South Houghton area, which potentially could happen. I doubt it, but it could happen. And the planning department suggested the 600-foot setback, and I am a specialist in finding spots for retail marijuana stores, and there are no spots right now available anywhere in Kirkland for a marijuana retail store that wants to be cited. And there's one more license that needs to be cited. If you reduce it to 400, there still are no more spots. If you reduce it to 200, there still are no more spots. If you reduce it to 100, there may be one or two more spots that are available in the Totem Lake area and in the South Houghton area. And so voting for anything between above 100 accomplishes nothing whatsoever. So it's a wasted energy, a wasted effort on the part of the council to look at this measure and just, you know, kind of hit it in the middle and think you're doing something right. It doesn't do anything. So the only way to make this measure work is to vote for the 100-foot setback, because that's the only one that allows new stores to be sited in a reasonably dispersed area, other than, you know, having it all cramped up over by Willows. So in light of all that, I suggest that you don't subvert the needs of the voters and vote for the 100-foot setback. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. The next person to have signed in is Jeff Anderson.
Hi there. My name is Jeff Anderson, and I am the aforementioned president of IHPP Corporation, which is the fourth retail marijuana licensee. And besides that, I'm a father of two teenage girls, and thankfully my wife is out with curriculum night tonight, and I get to be here. One of the things that I'm committed to is keeping cannabis out of the hands of those under 21. I'm on a coalition in Issaquah, so on and so forth. I've also helped open two retail marijuana stores, one in Renton and one in Auburn. They're both safe, successfully run. We staff 25 plus people at each store, and there's been virtually no community safety concerns at all. A little side note to what Wayne is saying about the setbacks is, from my perspective, the Houghton area is not really all that appealing to me. So I know that he said that, but just for the record, I heard some groans over here. I'm like, not going there. So in Kirkland, we've been searching for 6 months or more for the compliant retail space. And as Wayne said, there's virtually been no success with 1,000-foot buffers or with the 600-foot buffers. My experience tells me when I talk to the landlords, there's three reasons, one of which is they have commercial real estate loans that are backed by FDIC banks, and they don't want to risk the default of their loan with dealing with a federally illegal business. Some landlords just don't like cannabis in general. And thirdly, there's a lot of spaces that are tied up with multi-year leases and at decently low rates, such that if we wanted to try to sublease or get them out of there, there's no place for them to go. In addition, purchasing a property is really difficult, not only due to the valuations, but also due to the difficulty with financing. So reducing the daycare buffer to 100 feet will allow us and Wayne to vet many more properties and hopefully allow us to find a location that will work with ample parking and access and not necessarily in a house or in a warehouse type environment. It'll also enable in the future when these leasehold the leases come due to for those places that do have less than ideal locations to be able to find a better location in the future. So in short, we're committed to bringing a safe and high class shopping experience to Kirkland. Thank you in advance in considering the 100-foot buffer change. And also a little side note to what I prepared ahead of time. I'm not sure if the council is aware of what Redmond did, but they reduced the buffer zones to 100 feet with the rec centers, child care centers, public parks, transit center, libraries, and game arcades.
Sorry to interrupt you. Thank you very much, Mr. Anderson. The next person to have signed in is Geraldine Anderson.
Good evening. You
Welcome.
Even said it right. Thank you very much. And no relation to the other Anderson. I am here as a Kirkland resident, but more importantly, as a trustee on the Crisis Clinic Board. King County Crisis Clinic provides 24-hour service to those who are acutely ill. And in fiscal year 2015, you funded us for $15,245. And I'm here tonight to say thank you. With that money, we received 4,183 calls from Kirkland residents who were in acute emotional distress or considering suicide. Similarly, we have a resource line that directs the caller to emergency shelter, food, childcare, whatever. We have a huge database of public resources available, and from Kirkland, we took 1,960 calls. We also operate a teen link, which is high school students on the phone Monday through Friday receiving calls from other teens who are in distress. And from Kirkland, we took 111 calls. We also go into the high schools and junior highs and teach suicide prevention and strategies for children and teens to help one another when their friends are distressed. And for that, we served 634 Kirkland residents. So tonight, we are just saying thank you.
Thank you for being here, Ms. Anderson.
And I have a handout.
You can hand it. Thank you. The next person to have signed in is Kristen Leeson.
Hello. I am here with several of the residents of our neighborhood. We live in Bradford Place subdivision off of 70th Street in South Rose Hill. We have 17 single-family homes accessed off of 118th Place. It's a narrow local street. At the southwest corner of our neighborhood, three new housing units are about to be constructed that will be accessed off of 118th as well. On the Kirkland compound, as it's known, which is just to the east of our property, adjacent to our property, 26 new housing units, 16 single-family and 10 multifamily, are also about to be constructed. The Kirkland compound site alone will produce 253 additional car trips on 118th per day, resulting in 26 additional PM peak hour trips, which will more than triple the PM peak hour trips that we currently have. This is also going to add additional potential for accidents at the intersection of 70th, 117th, and 118th. According to the environmental checklist, determination of non-significance, and the traffic impact analysis, This project will not have any significant adverse impact on the existing facilities. Really? I find that kind of hard to believe with 253 additional trips. So we beg to differ. But the kicker of all this is that we found out about this from an arborist, not from the city. So I asked the planner for the development specifically, because of the zoning and the ability to do a unit lot subdivision, we really have absolutely no say in what happens and would not have anything known anything about this, the 26 new units and the 253 new trips on our street, until the construction trucks showed up and started tearing up our road. So at no point in this process is there a requirement for public notice, correct? The response was, there is no official public comment process, correct? I think this is a bit ludicrous. So the residents of our neighborhood have a request. It's too late to benefit us directly in this situation, but it may help benefit others in the future. Our request is that the City Council work with the Planning and Neighborhood Services Departments to improve your notification process. Find a way to notify existing residents of development, whether it is being platted or not, whether it requires traffic impact analysis or not, or that is something that something about their neighborhoods is going to change. You probably don't need to know that your neighbor is going to build a next door. But I would imagine that if three new houses were going to come onto your street and bring 10 new cars, you'd probably like a heads up. So now imagine that it's 26 new houses, 253 new trips coming onto your street, and I am pretty darn sure that you would like to know that that is coming before the construction trucks come. So development process allowed the zoning district and likely others to clearly expedite the process and requires no notification to adjacent property to adjacent residents. These are huge selling points for developers. I apologize.
I'm sorry.
But that's our request. Please fix it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think we have some council members taking notes, so thank you very much. The next person on our list is Scott Morris.
Good evening, council members. I'm Scott Morris from the Finn Hill area, and I represent the Finn Hill Neighborhood Alliance. And I just wanted to make a few comments about the Urban Forestry Annual Report that you'll be looking at later this evening. We also submitted some written comments to you earlier today. The two points are, first, that we applaud the city for having a very good urban forest management plan. We think it's an excellent plan, and we're happy to see that the city is tracking progress against that plan. We would add also that as we see the report, there's some areas in which the city staff feels it could do a better job, and one area in where we might be able to help as a neighborhood association is to turn out volunteers to help on some of the projects of tracking trees, inventorying trees, things like that. So we'd be happy to work with the city on that. Second, we note that the plan focuses primarily on public tree management. It does not address, to a great degree, trees on private property. But the city has a standard for urban tree canopy coverage of 50% for residential neighborhoods. And that's extremely important to residents in Finn Hill. We're going through a neighborhood plan process. One thing has come clear. Layout of the community meetings we have. People love the tree canopy. They love the feel of the neighborhood, and they're very concerned that that will be endangered as development moves on. And specifically, a development has been begun next to Juanita Drive. It's a 20-unit subdivision. Not all the trees, but hundreds of trees have been cut down. And it raises the question in our mind as to whether the city's goal of 50% tree canopy coverage in residential areas is backed up by the codes that it has. You've got a great goal, but are the tools sufficient to achieve that goal, and do you have the tools to measure progress against that goal? We're going to be working with the city staff on those tree ordinances and ones particular to our neighborhood. We hope we'll come up with some good ideas in the next couple of months. I think our only point tonight is to highlight the fact that this is important. We hope the City Council will support some of the recommendations that come out of that planning process. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. The next person to have signed in is Andy Henry. So I think that maybe...
Is it
going to be Honig?
Yes, I think maybe. Is it Andy? Sorry, Andy. Welcome. Sorry about that.
All right. First, let me apologize for my horrible handwriting.
Good evening, Mr. Honig.
My name is Andy Honig. I live in the North Rose Hill neighborhood, and I'm the owner of Higher Leaf Marijuana Boutique, one of the marijuana shops here in Kirkland. I'm here to support the planning recommendation of 600 feet for the buffers to daycares. I want to make a couple points that businesses that have been around for since this started and came to meeting after meeting made an enormous investment in the building where I'm at, and the rules, the 100-foot buffer really doesn't create any disbursement around the city. It actually just has more locations right in the Totem Lake area, which is where I'm at, and in better locations, which would really be damaging to my business, where I have made a very large investment, which I haven't had time to recoup. It was really just 16 months ago that you guys passed the ordinances that exist as they are today. I also want to point out that there actually are options to get disbursement around the city. There is the Market Street corridor, which was taken off the table. There's the spot by the old cannery, which at some point was considered for marijuana retail, that was taken off the table. And then there's, you know, the Redmond approach of going down 100 feet for everything, which I'd be supportive of all three of those, because that would actually achieve the disbursement that we're looking for, as opposed to, if you look at the map that they're talking about with the 100-foot buffer, it really is just better locations right near where the existing stores are, which makes it really hard for existing businesses. I also want to point out that three of the four people who were looking for licenses have been able to get one, so claims that it's impossible or should be taken with a grain of salt, considering three or four people have done it. And at this point, because the fourth license has been issued at a specific location, no one else has the opportunity to apply. It really is just up to the one party that has that license to try to go ahead and apply. I also want to echo some of the things brought up by the Planning Commission Committee. I know one of them was traffic and parking. We get 850 visitors a day. So parking is probably going to be an issue depending on where it is. I bought the building where my business is, and I had six tenants. Within the first 8 months, four of them moved out explicitly saying that parking was a disaster and they wanted to leave. So that is going to be a problem. It obviously has nothing to do with daycares. I think that's it. Oh, and one of the things that I do want to point out is when you hear something like 850 visitors, you might think that I'm sort of making tons of money and can afford to do, but I haven't been able to leave my day job. It's a very tough business. The margins are tough. The expenses are tough. The taxes are tough. It's a very hard business, and I've had to keep my day job. So thank you, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you. The next person to have signed in is Shannon Scovel.
Hi. I live in Bradford Place, as well as about nine other households that are represented here this evening. And imagine my surprise when I found out that there was going to be a development. If you've never been down our private street, this is my crude map. This is 70th. There's an old house here that's going to be torn down. Three townhomes will be going into it. This is a big compound here. We have a very narrow driveway. I videotaped the garbage truck entering and exiting our development on Friday. As the garbage truck enters or exits, no other car can come in or go out. Zero. All of the houses here utilize the street for guest parking. So thereby, this is no longer a two-width road. It is one car wide. And now you're talking about having another road put over here to access an additional 26 houses and 253 cars. And what I don't think Kristen mentioned was there are three driveways already off of 70th into this development currently that were not utilized or not taken into the plan because Toll Brothers came back originally with a 20-unit development, and they said, oh, no, we're going to put access off of 118th so we can get an additional six homes. So for us taxpayers that currently live in Kirkland and have been diligently paying our taxes and have lived in this beautiful, nice, sweet little community on a basically private street, you're now going to say, it's okay for another 273 cars. 273 cars in and out a day. If there's an emergency, a fire truck needs to get in, an ambulance needs to get in, that's not going to work. There are no sidewalks on either sides of this entrance coming in and out. It's already a blind entrance. It's very dangerous. All of the residents know we have to go slowly in because if there's a car coming out, we have to wait for them to come out. If you come in too quickly, you're going to T-bone somebody here. We've had two accidents here that were not reported to the police because for whatever reason they weren't. Very dangerous. And now you want to add another 273. And I just have to say, if it were your neighborhood, Amy, or if it were your neighborhood, Jay, would you be okay with that? Because I'm not. Not only are you adding all of that traffic, but you're taking away the safety of our neighborhood. And not to mention construction trucks. I mean, a construction truck is as big as a garbage truck. And if we're going to have all those construction workers, where are they going to park? Seems to me they park in our neighborhood, taking away our guest parking. We have houses that have no guest parking. We utilize on-street parking. It is a street that is only two cars wide without utilizing our guest parking. And so if you're looking at adding those additional cars, I ask you, please go back to your planning commission. Please talk to them about why this happened, why we weren't notified. There was no hearing. We found out from the tree guy. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. We appreciate your comments. We've reached the end of our sign-in sheet. Is there anyone else who wishes to address the council at this time? I do believe that we've had three speakers against the Sound Transit ballot measure. But other than that, I think we have room for a conversation on any other topic. Hearing none, I'll declare this items from the audience period closed. And we'll move. Yes, sir. Oh, yes, ma'am.
Yes.
Welcome.
Hi. My name's Cindy Spangler, and I'm with the Bradford Place people in unity about the situation at hand. Just to tack on to what Shannon talked about, I personally was one of the cars that was in an accident in the neighborhood when we actually only have about 30 cars on any given day that go in and out of there. And I got T-boned there on a blind coming in driveway. So the accidents have happened. It's happened to me. It was $10,000 worth of damage. And luckily, it didn't hit me where my driver's side was. The question, though, is if someone was walking or was riding a motorcycle, they may have been killed. But that's the past. The future right now is that we're talking about potentially 27 more homes coming in utilizing a driveway. It's not a street. On a map, it looks like a street, but it's a driveway. And I have videotaped, and I gave the videotape. I went in my car, and I actually have from personal driving in and out in the last week to let you guys see what this street looks like, what our neighborhood looks like, and how could this development get approved. Second, the Kirkland compound, what exists there right now is four homes. That's it. And we don't even see them because there's a huge wall and trees. And they have their own driveways that come out of 70th. So it was a shock to find out that a bunch of homes were going to get put in there. So right now, it's going from 0 to 60 in 2 seconds or in 2 years. So I ask that you look at not only the safety of this, but actually the planning and how, if we were to exist with this new community, how we're going to be able to do that. And lastly, we have a homeowners association, and we actually mandate that people don't park on our streets because it's private and there's not enough. There's two cars, as Shannon said, two car widths. You can't park on each side of the streets in our neighborhood. So it impacts our homeowners association. And so I've asked our president of the homeowners association to ask what our rights are as a homeowners association about this street and how we're going to coexist with this community and if they end up having to park and use any of our very limited guest parking. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. I wonder if we could get some information. I think the council would be interested in some information about the background of this.
Taking lots of notes.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who'd like to address the council? We'll declare items from the audience period closed, and we'll move on to item number 8, which is the consent calendar. Before we have a motion, I'd like to ask Councilmember Marchione, the chair of the Finance and Administration Subcommittee, to present the audit of accounts.
So we had payroll of $3,166,220.66 and bills of $5,079,514.87.
Thank you very much. Is there a motion to approve the consent calendar?
So moved.
Second.
Thank you. It was moved by Councilmember Asher, seconded by Councilmember Sweet to approve the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Mr. Nixon?
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I just wanted to highlight that there is the ordinance on the consent calendar on prohibiting parking in bicycle lanes. And I wanted to thank the staff for their good work in putting this together and the fact that the staff report includes all the commitments that I was looking for in terms of additional markings in the bike lanes and the community outreach. And I think that that this will work very well with those commitments in place. And it will help preserve the investment we're making in bike lanes by not having cars parked in them, blocking them. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments? Ms. Anderson, the roll, please.
Councilmember Nixon?
Yes.
Councilmember Kloba?
Yes.
Councilmember Asher?
Yes.
Councilmember Marchione?
Yes.
Councilmember Sweet?
Yes.
Deputy Mayor Arnold?
Yes.
Mayor Wallen?
Yes. Thank you very much. The consent calendar is approved. The next item on our agenda is item number 9. It's a public hearing. City Manager.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Mayor. So the council had asked us to bring you a resolution supporting initiative measure number 735. And under state law, that requires a public hearing before a council can take an action to support or oppose a ballot measure. So here to provide you with that presentation is Lori McKay, our Intergovernmental Relations Manager.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, City Manager. Madam Mayor, Deputy Mayor, Council Members, good evening. For the record, I'm Lori McKay, your Government Relations Manager. I'm going to take a few minutes to just briefly summarize this issue, how it came before you, current federal law, as well as a quick touch on the two methods of proposing amendments to the federal constitution, the Washington Secretary of State summary of Initiative 735, and then I'll conclude with a quick mention of the outreach staff has done to the for and against campaign representatives. So with that, statewide Initiative 735 concerns a proposed amendment to the federal constitution. Proponents gathered 330,000 signatures before the 2016 legislative session convened. Those signatures were enough to put it on the ballot this coming November on the, for the general election. The certified ballot title reads as follows. Initiative measure number 735 concerns a proposed amendment to the federal constitution. This measure would urge the Washington State Congressional Delegation to propose a federal constitutional amendment that constitutional rights belong only to individuals, not corporations, and constitutionally protected free speech excludes the spending of money. Should this measure be enacted into law, yes or no? At its July 5th meeting, a local resident asked council to consider a resolution in support of Initiative 735. Council requested that staff draft a resolution in support of Initiative 735 for consideration of public hearing tonight. Proposed resolution 5205 supporting 735 is on e-page 176 of your packet. Presently, under the law, the United States Supreme Court has held that the First Amendment to the United States Constitution protects the right of individuals to contribute money to candidates running for office and to spend money independently to support or oppose candidates. In 2010, in a case called Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, the Supreme Court held that the First Amendment also gives corporations a right to independently spend money to support or oppose candidates. At its core, Initiative 735 is designed to overturn the Citizens United decision. Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution describes a process by which amendments to the Constitution may be proposed. There are two methods. The United States Congress can propose constitutional amendments at any time if two-thirds of both houses of Congress agree, or by a constitutional convention called for by two-thirds of states' legislatures, which is about 34 states, or it is 34 states. ratifying an amendment then requires three-fourths of the states to approve it, 38 states. The Washington Secretary of State's office has a summary of Initiative 735, and it reads as follows. If passed, Initiative 35 would urge the Washington State Congressional Delegation to propose a federal constitutional amendment clarifying that constitutional rights belong only to individuals, not corporations, that spending money is not free speech under the First Amendment, that governments are fully empowered to regulate political contributions and expenditures to prevent undue influence, and that political contributions and expenditures must be promptly disclosed to the public. The measure would then urge the legislature to ratify such an amendment. If voters approve Initiative 735, Washington State would join 18 other states in formally calling for a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. So tonight, to provide you with additional information and details, staff invited representatives from both campaigns for and against Initiative 735. Jonathan Tong is here tonight to speak on behalf of Yes on 735. And then no one was available to speak on behalf of the No on 735 campaign. However, Kelly Houghton, campaign representative to the No on 735 campaign, requested that council be provided a copy of a transcript from a recent speech broadcast on TVW, and that should be at the dais for you tonight. Following the public hearing and considering the resolution of R5205, council may approve or reject R5205, modify the resolution, ask staff to provide additional information for action at a later date, or take no action. Do any members have any questions?
Any questions for Ms. McKay? Thank you very much. Mr. Arnold.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Before we open the public hearing, I want to make a disclosure. In the interest of full disclosure, I'd like to state that I do contract information technology work for Fuse Washington, an organization that has endorsed Initiative 735. Fuse Washington's endorsement does not impact my ability to consider the public input that we hear tonight to deliberate and vote on the resolution before the council.
Thank you very much. Mr. Asher.
In the spirit of similar disclosure, I'd like to disclose that I gathered a significant number of signatures to help get Initiative 735 on the ballot.
Anyone else care to share anything about this? Okay, and we're ready to move on. This is a public hearing to receive comment on proposed resolution 5205 concerning the City Council's support for initiative measure number 735. Following the public hearing this evening, the Council will consider the resolution, and I'll now open the public hearing. Do we have a list of speakers?
We do not.
No one has signed up to speak. Would anyone in the audience like to address the Council about our support for initiative 735? Thank you very much. So Mr. Tong is here. Mr. Tong, would you like to address the council? Great.
Thank you. Actually, well, thank you so much for giving me the chance to speak tonight. Thank you for bringing this resolution up. My name is Jonathan Tong, and I'm a high school teacher in the Edmond School District, and I also volunteered as faith outreach coordinator for the Initiative 735 campaign. Lori did such a wonderful job of summarizing everything about the initiative. I think she pretty much covered everything, though, that I could say about it. The only thing that I might add is that there are over 650 other cities and counties across the country that have passed similar resolutions endorsing such a constitutional amendment. So our hope is that Kirkland would join that number. This is one of the few things that Democrats and Republicans and liberals and conservatives all agree on. We all know that there's too much money that's corrupting our political system, corrupting our elections, corrupting our whole lawmaking and policymaking system. So insofar as our elected representatives no longer having the authority to limit how much money corporations or labor unions or very wealthy individuals, liberal or conservative, insofar as our elected representatives no longer have the authority or the ability to put any kind of reasonable limits on that political spending, because Citizens United has ruled that doing so would limit their constitutional free speech rights. We feel that this is really something that we have to do to amend the Constitution. And it's not just First Amendment rights. If you look at the frequently asked questions sheet I passed out, the good news is that a lot of people understand what Citizens United is and understand that it's something that's not so good for our democracy. But what a lot of people don't realize is that the whole problem of money in politics goes way back far beyond Citizens United and started way back over 100 years ago. And that there's a whole string of Supreme Court rulings, of which Citizens United is only one of the more recent ones, that have given corporations like McDonald's and Monsanto the same constitutional rights as you and me and every other person in the room. So the purpose of the constitutional amendment is really to settle this for once and for all, that constitutional rights are really meant for people, not for corporations or labor unions or any other special interest group. And that spending millions of dollars to buy elections is really not a form of free speech protected by the Constitution. So having said that, I wanted to leave time for questions and answers if you had any questions about the initiative or process or anything like that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tong.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to address the council? Please, sir. Oh, thank you. All right, the public hearing is closed. Is there any council discussion? Motion to, yes, please, Mr. Asher.
Madam Mayor, I'd like to move resolution 5205, supporting initiative measure number 735 concerning a proposed amendment to the federal constitution.
Second.
Thank you. It's been moved by Councilmember Asher and seconded by Councilmember Clova to approve resolution 5205. Would you like to make some comments, Mr. Asher?
Certainly. This is a very small step in the direction that I feel this country ought to take in moving to make elections fair. But it's a step. It's a step in the right direction. Probably a necessary step to move forward. I think that there's much further that we could go, and I hope that at least we take this step.
Thank you. Ms. Clova.
So the freedoms that we have in the Constitution are very dearly held, and I just think that it doesn't get any simpler than those constitutional rights belong to people. And corporations are not people. Judge Sotomayor really assessed that Citizens United decision as a step in the wrong direction. And one of the interesting things that we have as a right for our citizens is to be able to steer our government in ways that can help to correct missteps. So I think this is an important tool in the toolbox, and I look forward to the rest of our citizens taking a look at this when it comes to their ballot in November. And I think our process here helps to give them a little bit of guidance.
Thank you. Other comments? Ms. Sweet and Ms. Marcioni?
The last time we had this discussion, I was on the other side of this issue. I was wrong. Just watching the political process over the course of the last several elections, it's become very clear that we have to take steps in a direction that protects ourselves from what corporations can do. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Nixon and Ms. Marcioni.
Thank you. Of course, this isn't the first time this subject matter has been before the council. I don't remember exactly what year it was that we passed our own resolution, basically a letter to Congress asking them to take action on this. But I said then, and I'll say again now, that I disagree with the notion that corporations are not people. corporations most certainly are made up of people, particularly when you consider membership corporations that are formed specifically for the purpose of people gathering together under their constitutionally protected freedom of assembly to combine their voices to advocate for and against issues that are important to them. People who choose to jointly exercise their freedom of speech in that way, and the freedom of the press, too, when it comes to publishing things, should be able to choose to organize as a corporation, if that suits them. And just because they organize as a corporation shouldn't mean that the rest of us have the power to infringe on their freedom of speech and assembly. And despite the denials by the proponents of this initiative, it does exactly that. If this constitutional amendment were to pass, then labor unions would not be able to speak out, potentially, or support candidates. NARAL, PETA, the NRA, Institute for Legislative Action, pick the cause of your choice, many of them would potentially no longer be able to advocate for their members by funding campaigns or by buying independent ads to try to influence campaigns, whether it's on for candidate elections or whether it's for ballot measures. This initiative and the request that it makes no distinction between corporations that are expressly created to allow individuals to amplify their voices by joining together versus publicly traded for-profit corporations that are in the business of providing goods and services. And I think that's a deep flaw in the idea that we would prohibit membership corporations from being able to be a voice for their members. I also disagree that the Constitution should be amended to say that people can't spend their own money independently to buy ads to amplify their voices. And yet that is what's being called for here. It's one thing to say that you're going to put limits on contributions to candidates because of the nexus of, you know, corruption or influence peddling, those kind of things. It's quite another to say that you can't spend your own money directly, independently, and yet that's what's being asked for here. Fundamentally, I believe that when somebody is saying something you don't like, the answer is not to call upon the power of government to suppress their speech, which is what's being advocated for here. The answer is more speech. And so if somebody's better organized and has raised more money than you, then get organized and raise more money so that you can counter their speech. The answer is more speech. And we should not, as a council, be calling for giving the government more power to reduce speech than it has today. I do agree with one point in I-735, and that is that political contributions and expenditures should be fully and immediately disclosed. And they're not today. There's too much delay. There's too much lack of detail. So it's difficult today always to know who is funding. And you can have multiple layers of political committees that hide who's funding campaigns. Those tools for obfuscation should be eliminated, and contributions and expenditures should be immediately reported when they happen. But that one good thing about this initiative does not outweigh all the bad things about it. And so I urge you to vote no on this resolution and to vote no on Initiative 735. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments? I have a couple of thoughts about this topic also, and that... I didn't call in Ms. Marcioni. That's okay. Well... I mean, I think I have the opposite perspective a little bit from Councilmember Nixon in that we have a small business, and that small business is made up of individuals who have a perspective. It's an auto dealership, and we like to go to Olympia and say, you know, we have these interests, and be careful, you know, we talk to our legislators, and we can't give money to their campaigns, that sort of thing. On the other hand, I ran for office, and
the first thing they did is said, open your Outlook and call everyone you know and ask for money. And I think that is the worst part of American politics. And I think the thing that I dislike the most, that I hope the, and I believe there's more good in it than bad, so I will be voting yes, that the dark money, the political action, the independent expenditures, you know, the, how do you say it, Friends for a Better Kirkland. Who are the Friends for a Better Kirkland? For example, there's all these action committees that I think are very, very bad and not transparent at all. And this is a cry for more transparency, and I don't think, and so for that reason, I'll be supporting it, because I think we need to do something, and I think that our citizens want to have their voices heard, and this is a way of doing that. So, if there's no more discussion, the question is on the motion. It was moved by Councilmember Asher and seconded by Councilmember Kloba to adopt Resolution 5205 concerning a proposed amendment to the federal constitution. Will all those in favor please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
And those opposed say no.
No.
Thank you very much. Resolution 5205 is approved. The next item on our agenda is under item 10, unfinished business. It's 10A, the Kirkland Cemetery Policy and Procedure Review. City Manager.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Mayor, members of the council. So, when we had some challenges earlier this year at the cemetery, as you know, we have changed our policies and procedures and actions. And one of the things we did was we commissioned a thorough review of all best practices out there in the rest of the state. And that work was done for us by our graduate intern, Lindsay Mum, who is her about to go into her second year of her master's in public administration at the University of Washington. And she is also a Kirkland resident. So she is here to give you an update on what we have done. So, Lindsay.
Great. Thank you. Again, my name is Lindsay Mum, and I'll be presenting on the Cemetery Policies and Procedures Review this evening. For some background, the Kirkland Municipal Cemetery is operated within the guidelines of the Administrative Policy Manual and the Kirkland Municipal Code. This is a follow-up presentation to Finance Director Michael Olson's update to City Council on July 19th. The major tasks of the cemetery review include an update of the cemetery forms and procedures to be more comprehensive, perform a review of the cemetery records, schedule cemetery committee meetings on a quarterly basis to review documentation and issues of each prior quarter. The cemetery committee is comprised of the directors of Parks and Community Services and director of Finance and Administration, as well as cemetery staff in both departments. My presentation this evening will be focusing on tasks 1 and 4, updating the cemetery forms and procedures, and review and update of the cemetery policies. For the policy review, I reviewed the relevant revised Code of Washington chapters and Washington City Insurance Authority, WCIA, best practices on public cemeteries. I compared the city's cemetery provisions to the WCIA best practices and provisions from 50 other Washington state cemeteries. I incorporated some of the RCW language and the WCIA practices to strengthen Kirkland's policies and make them more comprehensive. We narrowed the comparison to 4 other mid-sized cities most similar to Kirkland: Auburn, Bellingham, Edmonds, and Puyallup. The purpose to narrow the comparison was to focus the review on Kirkland's peer communities. And also, there are many rural cemeteries in Washington state whose policies and practices are less relevant. The following are recommended changes to the Administrative Policy Manual, which will be approved administratively. We'd like to provide you with some highlights. First, to standardize the APM language and content to align with the KMC and current practice. Update the cemetery conduct rules and consequences for violating those rules. For example, clearly state that animals and food are prohibited in the cemetery. Also, update the listed order of next of kin, add a section to allow for the correction of errors, and clarify the limitation on liability for damage to cemetery memorials outside of reasonable care and maintenance. For the procedure review, I updated a cemetery administration staff desk manual by reconstructing it as a step-by-step guide for city administration staff. I also helped clarify communication between cemetery administration staff and parks operations staff. In addition to collecting more information and restructuring current cemetery forms, I also helped prepare a few new forms, including a new form for parks operations staff to more easily sign off on cemetery placements or disinterments on site at the cemetery. Also, forms to for individuals to declare that they are the next of kin and or have the right to inter and urn and or disinter, discern remains. For the summary of recommendations, we have the updates to the APM to better align with the RCWs, the WCIA best practices, and best practices from other Washington municipal cemeteries. Update the cemetery website to align with APM edits, update the cemetery administration desk manual, and update cemetery forms, including the property purchase form, the interment forms, and disinterment discernment forms. For next steps, the cemetery committee is moving forward with the process to implement these recommendations. Staff are continuing the detailed review of cemetery records and will be providing a progress report later in the year. There's also the possibility of a selected cemetery fee change, if necessary, which will also be brought forth in late 2016. And lastly, a housekeeping ordinance to update the KMC for consistent terminology between the KMC and the administrative policies, which will be brought forth as a consent item at a future City Council meeting. Thank you. And if there are any questions.
And fun and exciting project you've done. But a great job. Just
thank you. Mr. Asher.
Animals, you really think going to get away with that?
Prohibiting animals on
the pets, yeah. The family pets, particularly soon after a loved one is lost. I think you need to look at how you might provide some allowances.
Service animals are allowed.
I'm not talking about service animals. I'm talking about a family pet.
Labradors.
We can certainly take animals.
Or dachshunds.
I think maybe what you're getting at is because people who walk their dogs often are just looking for a nice green open space to right. make it understandable to people that recreational use of that space for dog recreation is not appropriate. It's yeah. not befitting the spirit of what respect and so on should mm-hmm. be there versus bringing a beloved family pet of the deceased could be considered a much different use of having a pet on the property. So maybe there's some concise way to word that.
Good luck with that.
I leave it to somebody better than I. But I think I see your point.
Yeah. Yep, me as well.
Yeah, we can
comments?
Certainly follow up on that. Take a harder look at that issue. I just say thank you to Lindsay. She's done a phenomenal job and definitely had one of the more unique assignments, I think, of any graduate intern to come out and work on our cemetery. And she's done an extraordinary job with a great attitude throughout the whole thing. So thank you, Lindsay.
I want to see how you portray this on your resume.
Yeah. I'll get back to you.
Thank you very much. It's a great memo, a great presentation. The next item on our agenda is also under unfinished business. It's item 10B. It's an ordinance relating to marijuana buffer requirements. City manager.
All right. Thank you, Madam Mayor. So we don't have a formal presentation for this since you got one at the last council meeting, and some of our staff are not available to be here. But Eric Shields, our planning director, is available to answer questions, and I think is particularly willing to talk if there's a discussion of 600-foot buffers versus 100-foot buffers and their impacts. So, Eric.
Yeah.
Look at that. You have more of a presentation than I thought. Thank you.
I'm just ready if you have questions, actually. So, I wasn't at your last meeting, but I understand the question of reducing the buffer from the 600 feet recommended by the Planning Commission was raised, and the council, there was not a full council contingent, so the matter was continued until tonight so that all seven of you can be here for discussion of that. And maybe I'll leave it at that as a presentation, but I do have some information that's available if that's helpful to you.
Was the matter continued or is the matter tabled?
When I read the memo, it said it was continued.
It was tabled.
It was tabled.
So does
it need to be taken?
On the table?
Does it?
I'll move by, to remove it from the table.
Yeah.
Move to remove from the table.
Second.
Thank you. It's been moved by Councilmember Marchione, seconded by Councilmember Asher to remove this item from the table. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Thank you very much. That is approved. So I'm wondering if it's in order to have a motion to approve Ordinance 4528, Mr. Nixon?
Well,
I doubt if he's going
to. Was there already a motion to approve the ordinance that was tabled, or was the matter tabled?
I believe the matter was tabled.
Okay, so we do need a motion.
Yes, sir.
So that's okay. Mr. Asher.
Madam Mayor, I'd like to move ordinance 4528 relating to land use and zoning and amending the Kirkland Zoning Code, Chapter 115.
Second. Thank you. It's been moved by Councilmember Asher, seconded by Councilmember Sweet to approve ordinance 4528. Discussion. Mr. Nixon.
Madam Mayor, I'd like to move that we amend the draft ordinance to change 600 feet on line 47 to be 100 feet.
Second. Okay, it's been moved by Councilmember Nixon, seconded by Councilmember Marchione to amend line 47 by replacing the term 600 feet with the term 100 feet. Discussion. You've probably already discussed this. Yes. Mr. Nixon and Mr. Arnold.
Yeah, I had rather lengthy remarks at the last meeting. I'm sorry that not everyone heard them then, but I will emphasize the key points, which is, number one, marijuana is safer than alcohol and should not be treated differently from alcohol, from my perspective. And we should be doing everything we can to eliminate the black market in marijuana. And that includes making it more convenient for people who want to buy legal marijuana in retail stores to do so. And I think that means we need to fulfill the mandate from the people and enable opening of licensed retail stores. I think it's pretty clear from the map that was in the packet that there would be no significant negative impacts to residential areas or schools by reducing the buffer to 100 feet. So I think that we should go ahead and change this from 600 feet to 100 feet. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold.
First, I wonder if, for the benefit of the public, if Mr. Shields could bring up the map of the 100 foot, the impacts of 100 feet, and describe what changed in the 100 foot compared to the 600 foot recommendation from the Planning Commission.
I'll show you the map. There's maps are in two forms, the north end of the city and then the south end of the city. So I'll start with here the map showing the 600-foot buffer for the north end of the city. And you can see all the bright red spots on this, or as it's coming up on the screen, it looks more like darker red. This is the map showing the 600 feet. And as I scroll down here, you'll see things change with the different buffer dimensions. So that's 600 feet. And it should be scrolling, but there's 1,000 feet. That's going the opposite way. Sorry, here we go, 800 feet. I guess you want me to get to 100 feet, so I'll just keep going. 400 feet, 200 feet, and finally, there we go, 100 feet. So I don't know if you caught all of that, but what's happening is the number of sites is increasing as you get to 100 feet. 100 feet has 130 eligible properties, 72 over the current regulations.
And given that the change there is the buffer, if the daycare here, daycare properties impacting the buffer are in blue, If we made no change to regulations today and those daycare closed, those properties that are listed in this 100-foot map would be eligible today.
Are you saying if the daycares left, that would open up new sites for eligible retail locations?
Yeah.
That's right.
Okay. So often I'm concerned about us as a council considering an option that wasn't fully considered by the Planning Commission. But in this case, it was part of the packets that were studied. And while their deliberations were a compromise at 600 feet, it was really a compromise there. And looking at these maps, with no change today, if the landscape of the daycare centers changed, you could have marijuana businesses in these parcels. So this is not a very big change into what is conceivable today. Our goal in originally adopting marijuana regulations in Kirkland were to set up a successful marketplace. Kirkland overwhelmingly supported legalization, and there was an interesting map on Kirkland Views that showed the precincts, and only three precincts in Kirkland voted against. Many precincts were 60% or more supportive. Many of the discussions that were heard in front of the Planning Commission were somewhat relitigating that. And I think we all have the goal of keeping marijuana away from our kids, but we believe that the best way to do that is through a secure, open marketplace. One thing that's changed is the legislature has merged the recreational and the medical marijuana businesses, and that's how we're going from the two stores that are open today to the four stores. And with that change, I think we need to respond to that and make more opportunities for stores to be cited to meet those. So I am supportive of the amendment, and I think that our action today doesn't do anything to increase the number of stores. It just allows them to be successful. Thank you.
Thank you. Other discussion? Mr. Asher, Ms. Kloba, Ms. Sweet.
Sure. City of Kirkland was in the forefront asking for flexibility in the legislature, so I think we had a major role to play in having this opportunity. We have analyzed it, and the staff and the Planning Commission and the Houghton Community Council have looked at it. Houghton does not want to entertain it. Planning Commission has proposed a 600-foot adjustment. I think at this time that's appropriate to make a modification, and it may someday, I would expect over time, will be reduced. But I think that for the adjustment at this time, we should take the recommendation of our advisors and implement the 600-foot buffer.
Thank you. Ms. Kloba, then Ms. Sweet?
Well, I want to take us back to when we first started having this discussion, and we had a quite lively and robust conversation over a period of time, a number of different meetings, and we really narrowed down the focus of the objections that people had. And I could summarize them that they were concerns about too much traffic in an area that couldn't handle commercial traffic, too much need for parking in an area that didn't have enough parking, and adjacency to school walk routes. And those were kind of the main concerns. And as I look on this map, I think those general principles are satisfied with the areas that would be opened up in the 100-foot buffer scenario. I see them as commercial areas that already have a lot of parking, and they already have a fair amount of traffic, and I think the idea that dispersing the retail stores throughout, you know, in more than one area of the community can help with, like we were talking about, give opportunities for people to purchase a legal product. I think the other concern that I have, and I think that this could be a tiny piece in that large problem that all our communities on the east side are trying to face, and that is the opioid addiction. And often it starts with in the medicine cabinet, and it starts with doctors prescribing something for pain that is narcotic. And I know from anecdotal as well as some medical evidence that marijuana can have a positive effect on pain without the addictive effect of narcotics. And so I think that having opportunities for people to access that as a pain remedy, I think, is also very good. So diminishing the black market, which was one of our original goals, I think this is still consistent with all of that. And so I'd be in favor of the 100 feet.
Thank you. Ms. Sweet.
Oh, this is such a fun conversation. You know, I agree, it's a legal product, but I also stated last time, and I'm going to state it again this time, I think we need to take baby steps. And I don't mean, I guess, as I understand the conversation that went on and some of it I've listened to at the Houghton meeting, there's still a great deal of fear out there. And I'm sensitive to that. As a matter of fact, I'm very sensitive to the fact that we're talking about legislation where, once again, Houghton won't be with us. And that troubles me. But I got to agree with somebody. So I'm going to agree with the Planning Commission, at least at this point in time. It doesn't open up enough. You know, if we really were to be open, we would have sites all over town. And I think we'd do what Mr. Honig suggests, which is look at what Redmond did. If we're really going to have it be a legal product. But at this point in time, I'm going to go ahead and support the Planning Commission's recommendation, so I don't cement the amendment.
Okay. Ms. Marcioni.
I am going to support the amendment. I feel that if the gentlemen are trying to open this door, I sincerely believe they have tried and looked everywhere and can't find anybody that will lease to them. And if this will help them get that fourth license in, and then if we want to look down the road at Redmond or whoever, we can. But I think we should try to help them with what they've been doing, and so I'm going to support the amendment.
I think, you know, my interest has been in not creating a marijuana neighborhood in Totem Lake. The reason that I was supportive of the action we took in Olympia was that it seemed to me that the Bridal Trails neighborhood, Business Center, and the Kingsgate and Finn Hill, and those, that's where marijuana stores should be located, and they should be not all in Totem Lake. So in theory, one would think that a 100-foot buffer would, you know, increase locations in Totem Lake as well as other neighborhoods, so I would be supportive, but I'm always loath to overturn or to go against our boards and commissions. We ask a lot of them. They wrangle with difficult issues. They come to us with a hard-fought compromise with a lot of work behind it, a lot of thought. So I am not supportive of the amendment because I want to honor the work that they've done. If we wanted to send it back to them and ask them about the 100-foot buffer, again, I would be supportive of that. This will open locations in other neighborhoods besides Totem Lake. The 600 to the 100. Do those neighbors know that this action is being contemplated? Have we reached out to their neighborhood associations or that sort of?
Well, we did give extensive notice of this first time around. When it came to the Planning Commission meeting, the hearing, and the joint meeting with the Houghton Community Council, we had maybe three people all total show up, maybe four, for the hearing, so very few people came to the hearing, but we did notify all of the locations, general locations, where this was going to happen, and I can't remember the distance, probably 300 feet from those, to get people aware that this was happening.
So the neighbors in the new areas wouldn't be surprised then?
They shouldn't be.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we have an amendment before us. It was moved by Councilmember Nixon and seconded by Councilmember Marcioni to amend line 47 to replace the term 600 feet with the term 100 feet. Will all those in favor please say aye?
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
No. So I believe that passes 4-3. And then the question is on the main motion to approve ordinance 4528. As amended, it was moved by Councilmember Asher and seconded by Councilmember Sweet. I believe we need a roll call, please, Ms. Anderson. Yes, sir.
Madam Mayor.
I'm sorry. Oh, there's more.
I noticed that on our on our desks, there was another amendment proposed. Was that intended to be considered, or has that been withdrawn?
I was the author of the amendment. I have not chosen to offer it.
Okay.
It was something I had prepared in case it was needed for to address specific
Just wanted
concerns.
To make sure we weren't skipping past something. Thank you. Sorry.
Thank you. That's all right. So the question, is there any further discussion on Ordinance 4528 as amended? If we could have the roll, please, Ms. Anderson.
Councilmember Nixon?
Yes.
Councilmember Kloba?
Yes.
Councilmember Asher?
No.
Councilmember Marchioni?
Yes.
Councilmember Sweet?
No.
Deputy Mayor Arnold?
Yes.
Mayor Wallen?
No. Thank you very much. Ordinance 4528 is approved. The next item on our agenda is under new business. Do we need a break? Or shall we press on? It's just the Urban Forestry Annual Report and Reports.
Urban Forestry Annual Report.
Shall we do it? Let's do it. It should be a pretty short item, I think.
It was a stimulating report.
Yes, very good report. Item 11, welcome, Ms. Powers. The 2015-2016 Urban Forestry Annual Report. Introduction, Mr. Triplett?
Well, just to say, as you can see from the top slide, this was an annual report we provide to you that updates you on what we're doing with our Urban Forestry Strategic Plan and outlining the two-year implementation in our current work plan, which is an element of that strategic plan. So here to give that presentation is our urban forester, Deb Powers.
Thank you. Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you for the opportunity to provide a status report on Kirkland's urban forestry goals. But first, let me back up a little to address this concept of urban forestry. We all know intuitively that trees are good, or at the very least, that they beautify the built environment. But more and more, we better understand the connection between trees in cities and human health, stormwater mitigation, all the benefits that are outlined in the Urban Forest Strategic Management Plan. And with the continual body of work, as in these recent findings that just came out between 2015 and 2016, that quantify the community benefits gained from a healthy, sustainable urban forest, which is why we want to strategically manage it. So with that, I won't repeat the memo, what's in the memo or in the report itself, but I think a lot of recognition goes to the Green Kirkland Partnership, Public Works and Parks Maintenance, and the Planning Department for a high level of cooperation and collaboration and accomplishments that are outlined in the report. Kirkland earned a growth award from the National Arbor Day Foundation in 2015 by earning 30 points over the required 10 for outstanding achievements in urban forestry management. So that's a testimony to how much we're all working together. We, meaning the tree team, the three different departments that were just mentioned that are involved with urban forestry management. Account, an honest account of milestones, comes also some setbacks, and the tree team and I think that we're not looking at public trees as assets with these enormous amount of public benefit, and that shows itself in the performance measures at the end of the report, that we're not building an urban forest program. We've, with over $100 million in tree-related expenses that Kirkland reported to the National Arbor Day Foundation for its Tree City USA status, Kirkland doesn't have a proactive approach to urban forest management. It doesn't speak to that amount of an expense. For example, the city could invest in properly maintaining its public tree asset rather than accrue public or tree-related claims, and you'll be looking at those tonight. And we're not alone, as in this article that actually Eric saw this first, that it was an article in this year's Washington Post that relays the disconnect between human health benefits and the investments that municipalities are not making in urban forestry. So, as with all strategic planning, whether it's a police strategic plan or the urban forest strategic management plan, it starts either any, start with core values or a mission, such as we're familiar with in Kirkland's Wordle, green, vibrant, livable, healthy, sustainable, that link to daily operations and long-range goals. And we use meaningful performance measures with that. This is a summary of Kirkland's performance in sustainable urban forestry, and it's a summary of the appendix table 1 in the annual report, which shows a more detailed account of what the benefits of different criteria in sustainable urban forestry and the consequence or risk of inaction. And this applies to both private and public trees, just in relation to Scott Morse's comment earlier. So just as a quick wrap up, I would be asking if the City Council agrees with the upcoming 2016-2017 proposed objectives, or if you have any questions or comments.
Questions or comments? Mr. Asher.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I'd like to get an inventory of the inventories. We've had multiple inventories and multiple inventories of street trees that have expended our money and money from the state, and I'd like for us to go back and look at what happened to that data.
I could say it right off the bat. We did a 2004 street tree inventory that was done before I came along, and that obviously it did not include the annexed area.
Right.
And we obtained a grant to get an inventory of 14 parks trees, and those are the formerly landscaped trees, not the open space forested area trees. So we have that done. That's in GIS format and a report that was attached to the annual report. We and City Council approved the funding for to update and include the annexed area in a street tree inventory, but we have not set out to do that because of other priorities. And we're also anticipating a maintenance management system called Lucity that will go be launched. I'd have to defer to Aaron on dates for that.
Okay, I had become, I'd thought that we'd done several more inventories than that, and that's when I started seeing, okay, now we're going to do a tree inventory. That sounded redundant. I'd like to see us do a good examination of the effectiveness of the tree regs in residential development and in commercial and office developments. I think we have some room for improvement. Scott Morris apparently agrees, at least in the residential developments. To that end, if we can take, like we used for the comprehensive plan update, and look at likely properties that are likely to redevelop, and take what we are seeing in as part of redevelopment, project that forward to 2040, what would our tree canopy be if we redeveloped all those likely properties? I think, would be very telling, given what we're seeing today with the developments, and probably lead to an adjustment in our regulations for at least residential development.
Right. What I would say in response to that is that was the purpose of our urban tree canopy assessment that we did back in 2011, with the purpose of seeing if the implementation of the city's tree code in 2006 was effective. So we had a benchmark year of 2002 canopy, and then we compared it with 2010 canopy in the pre-annexed city limits, and saw a net gain in every category and then citywide. So we've we've done that, and we have we can slice and dice that even more. But we can
You've got to update the data too.
Right, we have the data. It's just an intensive GIS project to analyze it further from what we have done, and we have projections to do another canopy analysis. We don't know yet if we're going to do that in-house or contracted out, but that would be probably in 2019.
If we can get that done sooner, I think that would be very helpful. And as I say, I think it would affect our development regulations as to what we're going to do for tree retention. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Clova, Mr. Arnold, and then Ms. Sweet.
So I support the idea of sort of Mr. Morris and what you're saying, Dave, about how do our different tree regulations and our goals align. And it would be, do we have enough, or is the data available to be able to do very similar to what you did, the benchmark in 2002 in the pre-annexation area, and then 2010? Can we take a look at that in the post in just the annexation areas? Because certainly they have more trees than the old Kirkland, and I think that the character of that neighborhood is related to those, and I think people cherish them. Is it possible that we could take a look at the changes over time? Because it would be great to be able to say that they're increased, but I have the feeling that maybe that's not true.
We
in that area.
We collected data. It's imagery, satellite imagery, in the annexed area, only with the 2010 data, so that with our next canopy assessment, we'd be able to compare trends in canopy if it's gain or loss. We could obtain earlier imagery in the annexation area, but that's quite an expensive endeavor because we need to purchase it. So it's possible, given we have the resources to do that.
Good use of one-time funds.
Possibly.
Or we could leverage that with grant. There's grant opportunities to do that as well.
Maybe I can jump in here a little bit. If this is something the council wants us to do, we can sharpen our pencils and come back to you with maybe some ideas as to how that could be done. So I would be interested in hearing from other council members if that's an issue that you feel needs to be done.
Sounds like it might be a budget discussion. I think I have Mr. Arnold, then Ms. Sweet.
The appendix of your report lists different criteria and performance indicators. There's a criteria for effective tree protection codes or ordinances that's listed as optimal. And given what you've described, Deb, I think that we have done a good job of getting to meeting our tree canopy goals. However, I think we're at the point where maintaining that tree canopy is going to be an entirely new set of challenges. And In looking at the work plan for the next year, I don't have any feedback on that. I think public trees are a piece of it and a good thing to focus on for the next year. But I do think we need to look strategically at saying, okay, what's the update of our strategic plan? Not just our work plan, but our strategic plan of saying, how do we maintain this forest? Because it may take different approaches than we've done in the past. And while you may evaluate our tree codes and ordinances optimal now, I don't think that means that we're done. I do think that we will need to look at it. But instead of saying, let's go look at the tree code, I'd rather say, let's go take a look at what's our strategy for maintaining our goal of canopy coverage, given as Mr. Asher mentioned, the development and the growth that we're expecting.
And if I could comment also, that also accounts for the shift in the Kirkland 2035 comprehensive plan revision from canopy goal, which is a quantity, to a healthy, sustainable urban forest and all the criteria that encompasses. So, for instance, amount of canopy versus the quality of canopy, where you could have, you could have a number of species that are in poor condition at the end of their lifespan, and if your whole canopy exists or predominantly of that, that's not a healthy, sustainable urban forest.
Ms. Sweet?
We are at this place, this very interesting place in the development of our city, where what we anticipated happening to support annexation is happening. Properties are redeveloping all over the city. And lots of trees are coming down because of it. I expect that when the properties were put in 35, 45, 55 years ago, trees came down then too. And I would anticipate that a lot of these properties are going to be planting. I guess what there's a replacement process that has to be incorporated into this thinking. And I don't know, I just want it to be a consideration as we move forward, because some of these houses are a lot closer together. I recognize that there's going to be variation. But how can we lead when we look at landscape plans, or when we, can we incentivize landscape plans that include more canopy? Or, if we're really going to get into this, I don't think we can simply go and strip developers' rights to use properties, or to property owners' rights to develop their properties, without looking at alternatives to sustaining a level of canopy. So I just want that to be part of the thinking.
And I agree wholeheartedly. Any other comments? Thank you very much for your report.
Thank you.
The next item on our agenda, and the final item, nearly, is City Council reports. So all of our committee reports are posted online. Are there any items of interest that anyone would like to report on out of a committee? Then regional reports, Mr. Nixon?
No.
Ms. Kloba?
No.
I know it's the summer break.
Yeah. Parks Public Works meets tomorrow.
Yeah. Mr. Asher?
Nothing tonight.
Thank you, Ms. Marcioni. Ms. Sweet?
Went to economic development luncheon, which was really well received. Got the continued good notice with an edge of pessimism. So that's about it.
It's been quiet tonight. Yeah. Mr. Arnold?
I would just note that tomorrow is the Sound Cities Awards dinner, and one of the awardees is Kirkland's own former mayor, John McBride, being recognized as Sound City, receiving a Sound City Legislative Award.
Yes, I'm driving if anybody wants to carpool. City Manager.
Okay, so covered a lot of ground in executive sessions and other things, so I don't have any policy updates, but I just wanted to see if there's any calendar additions. Remind you that we have our All-City Dinner on September 22nd, which is Thursday, but that we have postponed the Everest Neighborhood Meeting at their request, so that's not happening next week, and that should be reflected on your calendars. But any other additions or changes to the calendar?
Mr. Nixon.
Yeah, I have two things. The first is, as we heard in items for the audience, there's interest in the council taking a position on Sound Transit 3. I am one of those who would like us to pass a resolution in opposition. I'm sure there are others who would like us to pass a resolution in favor. And I'd like to suggest, maybe if the city manager is okay with this, that we have both resolutions prepared for consideration and schedule a public hearing at which we can listen to what our citizens actually have to say and then choose between them and see if either one of them can pass or if neither passes. I'm not sure how others feel about that, or if you would want to vote now on whether we're going to do yes or no later and have it settled. But I don't know. I kind of think it on the council, it may be kind of a close call. So, what would you think about doing both a yes and a no resolution for us to consider?
So just to comment as the city attorney reminded me, you couldn't decide on the issue itself without a public hearing being in support of a ballot measure. And obviously it's not my opinion that matters. As if a majority of the council would like resolutions for and against brought forward, we certainly can do that. And there's nothing that stops you from considering them both at the same time if the majority of the council is interested in doing that.
Maybe you should phrase it in the form of a motion, then, and we'll just take a vote.
Okay. I move that we direct the city manager to produce draft resolutions both in favor of and in opposition to the Sound Transit 3 ballot measure and schedule a public hearing for those to be considered.
I think that fails for the lack of a second.
I'll second that.
Oh, Mr. Asher seconded. Darn it. Thank you. Discussion? It's been moved by Councilmember Nixon, seconded by Councilmember Asher, to bring forward yes and no statements in support of Sound Transit 3's ballot measure. What was the second part?
Oh, and schedule
and
public hearing.
And schedule a public hearing to hear from the public. Discussion. Mr. Asher.
I would rather only bring one to oppose it, but I guess we could entertain the discussion.
Ms. Marcioni.
I just don't think it's a good idea. I think we all know it's. I think we all know it's going to be a very close vote, on a yes or a no. And I just think it could be too divisive with this council, and I don't think this is one we should go after.
So, may I? So, yes, so you're suggesting that the alternative is not to take any position at
right.
all, and not consider any resolution.
Suggesting.
Okay.
Other comments?
If I might.
Yes, sir.
The stake that Kirkland has and that Kirkland is losing in this proposition is, to me, monumental. And I think we should be in the game on this. We have fundamentally been disregarded, and I just think that we need to be a strong voice in this. We're talking, it will be 50 years before Kirkland will see any meaningful contribution from Sound Transit to transportation in Kirkland, and I think that's unconscionable.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Arnold and Ms. Kloba.
You know, without getting into the merits of discussing our position, Mr. Asher, on this, I do think that there is value in having the discussion within the community. We have committed significant resources of the city to do outreach and education on the opportunity for Sound Transit. We have a package that meets the needs of the final request that this council made, and having the information out in the community about what is in the package after all the discussions and controversy, how well we're served, and having the public hearing on that, I think is a useful benefit for the people of Kirkland and would support having the discussion. We may or may not be able to come to a conclusion on our position, but the discussion is useful, and I think we should move forward.
Thank you. Ms. Kloba.
Well, I had a snappy retort, but it doesn't sound as good with the delay. But to your question, how in 50 years, you know, where is Kirkland going to be? It'll be 50 years before we've seen it. How long will it be if Sound Transit goes down, how long will it be till Kirkland gets something? I mean, can you envision that it would happen sooner?
Yes.
Without the package?
Yes, since you ask.
And how
it's
would
not,
that
it's
be?
Not, it's not no Sound Transit 3 or nothing. It's Sound Transit 3 or the next plan that will follow up that should pay attention to Kirkland.
Well, I think we've had a nice preview of what our
better
what
pack
our conversation
lunch.
Might be like. And I agree with Mr. Asher that we should speak with a strong voice. And in this case, I don't think a 4-3, and it would probably be a 4-3 on either, would be a strong voice.
So that's the only reason that I will be voting against Mr. Nixon's, with all due respect, motion. I feel that we have provided a lot of information to the people of Kirkland, and usually that's why I want to have a public hearing, so we can have everyone speak. We've been talking about this for, it must be 2 years. Maybe it's more like 15 years. It feels like forever. And I think that there's a lot of material out there. We've presented a lot of material. We've done an awful lot of work. And all of that is available to our constituents if they want to find it. So with that, it was moved by Councilmember Nixon, and it was seconded by Councilmember Asher, to bring forward to direct the staff to bring forward a pro and con on ST3 ballot measure to the council and schedule a public hearing. Will all those in favor who want a yes and a no brought to the council please say aye?
Aye.
And those say opposed say no.
No.
No. Kathy, do you need a...
That was a soprano vote.
Did you get that count? You got the count. So could you tell me, did that motion pass or fail? It failed. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Nixon. That was an interesting conversation. All right.
Oh, I had a second item.
Oh, you did. Great.
This one's a little more interesting, maybe a little less controversial.
Gun control.
I would like us to consider the issue of online virtual reality games that induce people to trespass either on private property or public property.
Pokemon
many
Go.
Of you may know that Des Moines has had such a problem with Pokemon Go that they have formally requested Niantic, the company that publishes it, to remove all Des Moines' public facilities from the database because of the impact, especially after hours at like their marina and places like that. Here in Kirkland, you may know that one of our homeowner associations has been trying for months to get Niantic to remove their private gazebo from the Pokemon Go database without success. And so their gazebo, which is in the middle of their cul-de-sac, is just overrun by people searching for Pokemons.
And that's on private.
And that's on private property. Road. It is a private road. Yeah. And the company, I've tried contacting them, the Homeowners Association has tried contacting them. They have promised multiple times to remove it, and it has not been removed. And so maybe the only tool we apparently have right now to deal with this would be to file a lawsuit, which is unfortunate. And so I'd like us to think about, is there something else we could do as a city in the terms of having something in the city code that would create some cause of action short of filing a civil suit to motivate the makers of this type of software. And Pokemon Go is only the first of what will be many. And so I'd like to suggest that we refer that to the Public Safety Committee for consideration. I didn't check with the chair in advance.
As long as Brenda can play.
As long as it's Public Safety Committee, that's fine.
Public Safety Committee, is everyone all right with that? Going to Public Safety?
Sure. I have...
Do you have
any? We'll put it underneath.
I have the challenge of taking public facilities or public places and trying to put a restriction prospectively on it. But let's have the conversation.
Well, and if I could clarify there, the issue is that there are, of course, some public facilities that are closed to the public, like our maintenance yard, for example. And in the case of the Des Moines Marina, it was after hours, late at night, that this was going on. The marina is officially closed, just like our parks close at 10 p.m. And so that was the issue for them.
Thank you. Ms. Clova?
Just one
thing. Do you want it in your committee instead?
Oh, no, I'm sure it's more having to do with public safety.
It's recreation.
But having a teenager who was removed from a park because she was in it after hours and trespassing, I feel like, is this
One of the questions I want you to consider as a committee is, don't we already have solutions for this? If someone's trespassing, you can remove them for trespassing. And so just considering, does there need to be an additional solution?
That's basically the question that I want to investigate with the city attorney and the police about what's the appropriate solution for this.
Eliminate our Wi-Fi.
Sounds like the council is very supportive of this going to public safety. Thank you very much. Do you have anything else for our city manager?
I do not. That's all I have.
Thank you very much. Then we have time for the final item on our agenda, which is the items from the audience. This is the additional time in our meeting when we hear from the public on matters which are not quasi-judicial or otherwise scheduled for public hearing. Because it's before 10 p.m., we have an additional time in our meeting for you to come speak with us. Is there anything you would like to say? Are you sure? Okay. Great. Then we'll call this. I'll close the items from the audience. And before adjourning, we'll be going into an executive session to discuss pending and potential litigation with our city attorney. I expect our executive session to last approximately 30 minutes, but it could be shorter or longer. After the executive session, we will reconvene for the purposes of adjourning this meeting.
You will reconvene.
We'll be back.
Boy, are you short-term or what?